Eleanor Whitmore pulled the ugliest dress she owned from the back of her wardrobe and put it on with both hands steady. Her mother was downstairs arranging flowers for a man who had come to judge her daughters. Eleanor had been judged her whole life. She was tired of dressing for it. She looked at herself once in the mirror, brown wool in July, heat fraying at both cuffs, and felt something close to peace. If he wants a wife, let him find one elsewhere. I won't perform. She had no idea the man waiting downstairs already knew her name. If this story is speaking to you right now, subscribe to our channel and follow Eleanor's journey all the way to the end. Drop a comment and tell us what city you're watching from. I want to see exactly how far this story travels. The summer of 1815 arrived in Boston with the kind of heat that made silk stick to skin and manners turn thin. The Whitmore house on Beacon Hill stood 3 stories tall, its windows open to catch whatever breeze the Charles River offered its parlor, arranged with the precision of a woman who understood that appearances managed correctly could substitute for almost anything else. Margaret Whitmore had been managing appearances for 23 years. She had managed the appearance of a happy marriage when her husband spent more evenings at his club than at his dinner table. She had managed the appearance of prosperity when 3 bad shipping seasons nearly broke the family. And for the past 5 years, she had been managing the appearance of 2 marriageable daughters, one of whom cooperated beautifully, and one of whom, God help her, did not. Eleanor was the one who did not. Downstairs in the kitchen, the cook was already sweating over a leg of lamb that wasn't going to be ready in time. The housemaid was polishing silver that had already been polished. Margaret Whitmore stood in the front hallway checking the arrangement of dahlias in the entry vase for the 4th time, and she was calculating in the way she always calculated how much time she had before everything could still go wrong. "Is Eleanor dressed?" she asked without turning around. The young maid, Bess, hesitated at the top of the stairs.
She says she'll be down shortly, ma'am."
"That is not what I asked." Another pause. "She's choosing her dress, ma'am." Margaret turned then. Something in the way the girl's eyes refused to hold steady told her exactly what was happening 2 floors above her head. Her jaw tightened. "Go up there," she said, quiet and precise, "and tell my daughter that the Duke of Ashford's carriage was seen turning onto Charles Street 4 minutes ago, and if she comes down in anything less than the blue silk, I will personally see to it that she regrets this morning for the remainder of her natural life." Bess went up the stairs at something close to a run. She came back down alone. Eleanor heard her mother's message through the closed door, delivered in Bess's frightened half-whisper, and she sat on the edge of her bed and looked at the dress she had already chosen. It was brown wool. It was appropriate for November, not July. It had a collar that sat slightly wrong on the left side because Eleanor had mended it herself 2 years ago and hadn't done it well. The hem had been let down once, and the original line was still faintly visible, a ghost of where the fabric used to end. It was by every reasonable measure the worst dress Eleanor Whitmore owned. She had chosen it deliberately. "Tell her I'll be down in 10 minutes, Eleanor said. Bess made a small pained sound.
"Miss Eleanor."
10 minutes, Bess." The maid left. Eleanor stood smooth the front of the wool dress with both palms and looked at herself in the small mirror above her washstand. The heat was already making the back of her neck damp. She didn't care. She looked at her own reflection for a long moment. Dark eyes, unsmiling mouth. The collar sitting wrong and something that might have been satisfaction moved briefly across her face. Her father had spent the past 3 weeks informing her at intervals designed to wear her down that the Duke of Ashford was coming to Boston on political business, that he had an estate in Virginia the size of a small county, that he was unmarried, and that he was, according to those who knew these things, looking to settle a question about his future before the end of the year. The question being a wife. Eleanor's father had said the word opportunity 11 times in 3 weeks. Her mother had said obligation 14 times. Her younger sister Cecily had said almost nothing at all, only looked at Eleanor with her large, careful eyes, and kept her opinions to herself, which was how Cecily survived in this family. Eleanor had listened to all of it. She had thought about it carefully, the way she thought about everything carefully, in the quiet of her room, with a book open in her lap and the real conversation happening only in her own head. And she had reached a conclusion. She would not pretend.
She had been pretending to be smaller and softer, and less than she was, since she was 15 years old, since the season. She'd made the mistake of arguing with Mr. Aldgate at her mother's dinner table about the nature of property rights, and she'd watched her mother's face go white and still, and she'd understood for the first time with real clarity what was expected of her. Not intelligence. Not honesty. A performance. A particular kind of feminine performance that required her to stand in rooms and smile and say almost nothing and let men believe they were the most interesting people present. She was 21 now. She was tired. If the Duke of Ashford wanted an ornament, he could find one in any drawing room in Boston. Eleanor Whitmore was not going to put on the blue silk and walk downstairs and pretend. She put on the brown wool instead. The drawing room went quiet when she entered it. Her mother was already there, seated in the chair nearest the door positioned. Eleanor understood, so that she could intercept any disaster before it fully materialized. Her father stood near the window, hands clasped behind his back, face arranged in the expression he used when he needed something. Cecily sat on the settee in a pale green dress that fell perfectly from her shoulders, her hands folded in her lap, her expression composed and a little blank, the way it always was when she was trying not to feel anything. And then there was the other man. He was standing near the fireplace, not sitting, which was the first thing Eleanor noticed, because guests sat. That was the convention. They sat and waited, but he was standing with his back half turned to the room, apparently examining something on the mantelpiece. He was taller than she'd expected, broad across the shoulders in a way that wasn't performative, just structural. Dark coat, simply cut. No unnecessary ornamentation. He turned when she came in. Eleanor stopped walking. Not because of how he looked, because of how he looked at her. Most men, when they saw her come through a door in that dress, had one of two reactions. They either dismissed her immediately, eyes sliding past, expression closing, or they produced a particular kind of embarrassed pity. The polite social blankness that meant I see the situation and I will pretend I don't. She had cataloged both reactions over years. She knew them the way you know weather patterns when you spend enough time outside. The Duke of Ashford did neither. He went still. Not with surprise, exactly. More like recognition. Like a man who had turned a corner expecting one thing and found another, and was taking a moment to recalibrate before he moved. His eyes were gray, she noticed, and direct in a way that made the back of her throat tighten with something she couldn't immediately name. He looked at her for 3 full seconds without speaking. That was long enough to be unusual. Long enough for her mother to produce a sharp small sound that wasn't quite a word. Then he said, "Miss Whitmore." Not with condescension, not with pity. His voice was even and unhurried, the voice of a man who had never needed to speak quickly because the room always waited for him. Eleanor said, "Your Grace." She walked the rest of the way into the room and sat in the chair across from the settee, the one nobody had directed her toward, because it was too far from the Duke and too close to the door, the wrong chair entirely by her mother's calculations. She sat in it anyway. Her mother's face was a controlled catastrophe. "We are so pleased to welcome you," Margaret said, pivoting to the Duke with a smile that probably looked natural to people who didn't know her. "Boston has been anticipating your arrival. I do hope the journey wasn't too fatiguing. July on the coastal roads can be dreadful." "It was fine," the Duke said. He had not stopped looking at Eleanor. Her father, sensing the temperature of the room shifting in ways he couldn't quite predict, moved toward the center of it. "Well, Alexander, if I may, we are delighted to have you. Can I offer you something before dinner? I have a Madeira that arrived last month from—" "In a moment, Thomas." The Duke finally moved, crossing the room in a few unhurried strides, and stopped in front of Eleanor's chair. He looked down at her. She looked up at him. "Do you still read philosophy?" he asked. The room went completely silent. Eleanor felt her mother stop breathing, felt her father's confusion like a shift in barometric pressure, felt Cecily's careful stillness on the settee. She said, "Excuse me. Philosophy." His voice was neutral, patient. When we met 3 years ago at your cousin's house in Cambridge, you were reading Wollstonecraft. You told me it was the second time through because the first time you'd read it too quickly and missed the argument in the third chapter. I want to know if you're still reading. Eleanor stared at him. 3 years ago, she had been 18. She had been at her cousin Sarah's house for a fortnight in the summer, escaping her mother's campaign to turn her into something marriageable, and she had spent most of her time in Sarah's garden with books she'd borrowed from Sarah's husband's library. There had been a dinner one evening. There had been a man she remembered him now surfacing slowly from somewhere she hadn't known she'd kept quiet. Watchful, who had sat across from her and said almost nothing for an hour before asking her about the book in her lap. She had told him. She hadn't thought much of it at the time. He had seemed like a man worth talking to, which was rare enough to be notable, and she had talked to him for 40 minutes about the nature of rational argument and the systemic exclusion of women from public discourse. Then the dinner had ended, and she had gone home, and she had not in 3 years thought of him again by name. He had apparently thought of her. Eleanor said carefully, "You remember that." "I remember everything about that conversation," he said. "Simple, factual, without apology." "Alexander," her father said, with the slightly strained tone of a man trying to redirect water already over the bank. "Perhaps we might..." "Yes. Forgive me." The Duke straightened. He turned to acknowledge Thomas Whitmore with a small nod. "You were saying about the Madeira." But before he turned fully away, his eyes came back to Eleanor's face one more time, and he said quietly enough that only she heard it, "You haven't answered my question." Eleanor looked down at her hands in her lap, at the fraying cuff of the brown wool dress, at the hem that showed the ghost line of the old length. "Yes," she said. "I'm still reading." Dinner was its own kind of theater. Margaret Whitmore had arranged the table so that Eleanor would be at the far end near Cecily, away from the Duke and the main conversation. Eleanor sat where she was placed and ate lamb that had been overcooked by 40 minutes and watched the table's dynamics the way she watched everything quietly from a distance, taking inventory. Her father talked. He was good at it, had a politician's instinct for the shape of a conversation, when to press and when to yield. He spoke about the shipping trade, about the question of British interference with American vessels, about what the new round of tariff debates in Washington would mean for Massachusetts commerce. The Duke listened and answered briefly, and asked at intervals sharp, specific questions that revealed he had thought about all of this considerably more than he let on. Cecily ate in her careful, quiet way, and said almost nothing. Her mother steered the conversation toward lighter ground, twice toward the upcoming social season, toward the gardens at a neighbor's estate, and twice the Duke returned it with courteous inexorability to something with substance. Eleanor watched him do it and felt something unwilling stir in her chest. He was not performing. That was what she kept coming back to. Every man Eleanor had sat across a table from in the past 3 years had been performing, performing intelligence, performing importance, performing interest. The Duke of Ashford was simply present in a way that was almost uncomfortable to witness, like standing near a fire that was giving off more heat than you'd expected. Her mother leaned toward her during a moment when the Duke was speaking to her father about the Virginia tobacco situation, and said, beneath the cover of the table conversation in a voice like a blade, "Eleanor, you will participate." "I am participating," Eleanor said. "I'm eating dinner." "You know what I mean." "I know exactly what you mean. You want me to smile and say pleasant things and demonstrate that I can be managed." Eleanor picked up her water glass. "I'm not going to do that." Her mother's eyes went flat. "You are impossible." "Yes," Eleanor agreed. "I've been told." Across the table, there was a small pause in the conversation between her father and the Duke. And Eleanor, who had not looked directly at the Duke since they'd sat down, looked up and found him already watching her. Not her mother, her. His expression was entirely neutral, the careful blankness of a man who was listening to two conversations at once and filing both of them away. He picked up his wine glass. His eyes didn't move from her face. He drank. Eleanor looked away first. After dinner, the men withdrew to her father's study in the way that men did the conversation, flowing naturally from the table into a room with more whiskey and fewer women, and Eleanor found herself in the parlor with her mother and Cecily, and the peculiar aftermath silence that followed a dinner that had not gone according to plan. Cecily came and sat beside her on the small settee near the window. "He remembered you," she said very quietly. "So it seems. From Cambridge, 3 years ago." Cecily was quiet for a moment. "Do you remember him?" "I remember the conversation," Eleanor said. "I didn't know who he was." "He knew who you were." Eleanor looked at her sister. Cecily had their mother's coloring fair with soft blonde hair that curled the way hair was supposed to curl, but she had their father's eyes, and behind those eyes, there was more going on than she generally let people see. Eleanor loved her for it. "What are you saying, Cecily?" "I'm saying," her sister said carefully, "that a man who has sat at 100 dinner tables and 100 social gatherings in 3 years remembered you specifically enough to ask about the book you were reading." She paused. "I don't think that happens by accident." From across the room, their mother's voice cut cleanly through. "Girls, come and help me rearrange the dessert china. We'll have tea when the men return." They separated. Eleanor moved toward the sideboard with the tea things and thought very carefully about a man who had stood near a fireplace and gone still at the sight of a brown wool dress in July heat. She thought about the way he had looked at her. Not with pity. Not with dismissal. With recognition. Like someone who had been looking for something in a large dark room and had with no particular drama found it. The men returned from the study earlier than she'd expected. Her father was talking about the port situation again. The Duke was nodding in the way that meant he'd already processed the information and moved past it. They came into the parlor, and the evening rearranged itself around their entry, her mother moving immediately to orchestrate tea and seating, and the particular social geometry that she managed the way a chess player managed a board. The Duke sat. Not where her mother had positioned a chair for him near Thomas Whitmore. He moved a different chair, picked it up, and set it down so that it faced Eleanor's position near the window. Her mother noticed. Her expression didn't change, but something behind her eyes went tight. Eleanor looked at the Duke. He looked back at her with the gray directness that she was already, with some alarm, beginning to find steadying. "You were going to answer my question," he said. "In the drawing room. You said yes, you're still reading. What are you reading now?" Eleanor's mother cleared her throat. "Your Grace, perhaps we might lock," Eleanor said. Her mother stopped. "The second treatise." Eleanor continued watching the Duke's face for the condescension she expected the polite blank smile men produced when a woman said something unexpectedly serious. The smile that meant how charming, how unusual, and didn't find it. "The sections on property and natural rights. I find myself with questions about how the arguments hold when you apply them to persons who are legally classified as property themselves. The text doesn't address the contradiction, and I find that absence interesting." Silence in the parlor. Her father was looking at her with an expression that suggested he was recalculating something. Cecily had gone very still. The Duke said, "Which edition?" Eleanor blinked. "I beg your pardon." "The edition. The 1713 printing has marginal notes from the printer that I find complicate the property argument in interesting ways. Are you reading that one or the 1728? She stared at him. "I have both," he said. "I find them worth reading in sequence. The 1728 tends to be cited more broadly, but the earlier edition is more honest about the political circumstances that shaped the argument." He tilted his head slightly. "Your question about persons classified as property Wollstonecraft gets closer to it than Locke. She was asking the same thing from a different direction." "I know," Eleanor said. "That's why I read her first." Something shifted in his expression. Not quite a smile. Something quieter than a smile. Something that looked, she thought, like the expression of a man who had just confirmed something he'd suspected for 3 years. Her mother said, "Shall I pour the tea?" in the voice of a woman trying to pour water on a fire without anyone noticing the flames. The Duke said, "Yes, thank you," without taking his eyes off Eleanor. And Eleanor Whitmore, in her brown wool dress with the fraying cuffs and the ghost hem, and the collar that sat slightly wrong on the left side, felt something happen in the center of her chest that she didn't immediately have language for. She had come downstairs this morning prepared to be rejected. She had not prepared for the alternative. The tea grew cold in its cups before anyone thought to drink it. That was how Eleanor would remember the rest of that evening, not by what was said, but by what wasn't. By the way the parlor held its breath around two people who were supposed to be strangers and somehow weren't. By the way her mother kept reaching for conversational threads and finding them already pulled from her hands. By the way her father watched the Duke of Ashford with the careful eyes of a man who had invited a guest to dinner and discovered somewhere between the lamb and the lock that the guest had an agenda he hadn't anticipated. The Duke stayed 2 hours past what courtesy required. He didn't seem to notice. Or rather, Eleanor revised this watching him. He noticed everything, and simply didn't care about the things that weren't worth caring about. He had that quality she was discovering of a man who had spent enough time in rooms where everyone wanted something from him, that he'd gotten very precise about where he spent his attention. And he was spending it with a consistency that was beginning to make the back of her neck warm on her. Her mother had tried 3 more times to redirect the conversation. Once toward Cecily, who answered sweetly and briefly, and then went quiet again. Once toward the social calendar, which the Duke acknowledged with a short nod and then abandoned. Once toward a comment about the Whitmore family's history in Massachusetts shipping, which actually caught her father's interest and opened a 10-minute channel that gave Eleanor a brief reprieve. She used it to think. She sat with her hands in her lap and her back straight and her face composed in the expression she used when she needed to look like she wasn't doing anything important, and she thought about the Duke of Ashford with the methodical honesty she applied to everything that unsettled her. He was not what she'd expected. She'd built a picture of him from her father's descriptions. Important, wealthy, looking for a strategic marriage, and she'd understood what that meant for a woman like her. It meant she would be evaluated, measured against some invisible standard and found either adequate or insufficient, and the judgment would have nothing to do with who she actually was. She'd dressed for that judgment this morning, dressed against it, put on the worst dress she owned and come downstairs as a kind of refusal. He had not judged her. He had remembered her. That was the thing she kept turning over quietly while her father talked about the shipping lanes and her mother resettled the tea service for the third time. He had remembered a conversation from 3 years ago. Not her appearance, not her family's name, or her father's connections, or whatever social calculation might have made her worth remembering. He had remembered what she said. The book she was reading. The specific chapter she'd mentioned. Eleanor was not a woman who frightened easily. But she was. She acknowledged to herself in the privacy of her own thoughts, a woman who was currently frightened by something she couldn't yet name. When the Duke finally stood to leave the parlor, reorganized itself with the slightly stunned quality of a room that has been held at a particular pitch for too long. Her father shook his hand with visible relief. Her mother made arrangements for Thursday, a suggestion the Duke accepted without particular enthusiasm and without refusal. Cecily said a graceful goodbye and disappeared upstairs with the talent she had for vanishing from situations before they became complicated. Eleanor stood near the window. She wasn't going to walk him to the door. That wasn't what she did. He came to her instead. Miss Whitmore. He stopped 2 feet away, which was correct by every social measure, and looked at her with those direct gray eyes. I enjoyed this evening. Did you? She said. It wasn't a question. I did. More than I expected to. A slight pause. I didn't expect to, for what it's worth. Eleanor looked at him. What did you expect? He was quiet for a moment. Not the quiet of a man choosing his words, because he was worried about them. The quiet of a man who was being honest and wanted to be precise about it. I expected Boston, he said. I did not expect you. She didn't know what to do with that. She filed it away in the part of her mind where she kept things that required more thought than she currently had access to. Good evening, Your Grace, she said. Good evening, Miss Whitmore. He inclined his head, then very quietly before he turned, the 1713 edition if you want it. I'll have it sent over. The marginalia are worth reading. He left. The front door closed. Eleanor stayed where she was for a long moment, listening to the sound of carriage wheels on cobblestone diminishing down Charles Street. Her mother's voice came from directly behind her, low and controlled and furious. "That dress will be burned tomorrow."
"It won't,"
Eleanor said, and went upstairs. She didn't sleep well. This was not unusual. Eleanor's mind had always run late into the night, the thoughts not quieting with the house, but continuing their patient inventory, regardless of what her body needed. She lay in the dark and listened to the city settle and thought about gray eyes and a specific edition of lock, and the way a man had moved a chair without asking permission and positioned it to face her like it was the most natural thing in the world. She thought about what Cecily had said. "A man who has sat at 100 dinner tables remembered you specifically." She thought about what that meant. Or rather, she thought about what she was afraid it meant, which was not the same thing. Because Eleanor Whitmore had a rule. She had constructed it carefully over years of watching how things went for women who allowed themselves to want what society had decided they weren't allowed to have. The rule was simple. Do not build expectations around men who have the power to demolish them. The Duke of Ashford had more power than most. He was unmarried and titled and politically connected and wealthy in the way that people who had always been wealthy were wealthy, the way it was simply a fact about the atmosphere around them rather than a condition. Men like that did not choose women like Eleanor, women who argued at dinner tables and wore the wrong dress on purpose and refused to perform the particular softness that society required. Men like that chose ornamental women. Beautiful, compliant women who reflected well and caused no complications. Eleanor had made herself as non-ornamental as possible. It was, she understood, somewhere beneath the argument, a defensive maneuver. You could not be rejected for failing to be something you had already refused to try to be. The problem was that the Duke didn't seem to be interested in ornamental. She turned over in the dark and pulled the sheet up and told herself very firmly to stop thinking about it. She thought about it for another 2 hours. The book arrived the next morning before breakfast. Not a servant, not a note through the usual channels. A messenger from the Duke's household delivering a slim package wrapped in paper to the Whitmore front door before Eleanor's mother was even downstairs. Bess brought it up with an expression of someone trying very hard not to have an opinion. Eleanor opened it at her writing desk. The 1713 edition of Locke. Worn at the spine, pages slightly foxed at the edges with age and use. And inside the front cover in a handwriting that was angular and economical without being careless. The marginal note on page 47 is the printer's own. Read it against chapter 5 and see if the contradiction you identified doesn't sharpen considerably. A.H. Eleanor read the note 3 times. Then she turned to page 47. She was still reading when her mother knocked and entered without waiting.
"What is that?"
"A book," Eleanor said without looking up.
"I can see it's a book.
Where did it come from?"
"The Duke sent it."
Silence. Eleanor turned a page.
"He sent you a book."
Her mother's voice had the quality of someone parsing a sentence in a language they hadn't expected to encounter. "Alexander Harrington, Duke of Ashford, sent you a book this morning. The 1713 Locke. He mentioned it last night." Eleanor found the marginal note on page 47. "Read it." Felt something click quietly into place in an argument she'd been working on for weeks. He was right. The contradiction does sharpen. Her mother crossed the room and stood beside the desk. Eleanor could feel the precise calculation happening in the woman beside her. The rapid inventory of implication, the social mathematics, the rearrangement of expectations. Margaret Whitmore had spent her life being excellent at this, reading situations, understanding what they meant for the family, for the daughters, for the particular game that women of their class played in order to survive. "Eleanor," she said carefully, "if the Duke of Ashford is showing you this kind of attention..."
"I know what it looks like, Mother. Do you understand what it means?"
Eleanor finally looked up. "I understand several things it might mean. I don't know which one is true yet."
She closed the book, keeping her finger on page 47, and looked at her mother squarely.
And before you start arranging things, you should know that I'm not going to be arranged.
No one is arranging anything. You arranged the table last night to put me at the far end.
Her mother's expression didn't change.
That was practical.
It was strategic, and he moved a chair to undo it.
Eleanor picked up the book again.
I'm just noting that he's a better strategist than you.
She heard her mother take a breath. The long, controlled breath of a woman who had been managing a difficult daughter for years and had not yet found the approach that worked.
Thursday, Margaret said finally.
He agreed to Thursday. We're going to the Aldridge reception and he'll meet us there. You will wear the blue silk.
I'll wear what I choose to wear.
Eleanor?
Good morning, Mother.
Another breath. Then the sound of footsteps and the door and silence.
Eleanor opened the book back to page 47 and read the marginal note again.
And despite everything she'd told herself in the dark last night about rules and expectations, and the specific kind of danger that came from letting yourself want something, she found herself smiling.
Thursday arrived with the social machinery of the Boston upper crust running at full capacity. The Aldridge reception was at a house on Tremont Street. A family with old money and newer connections to the state legislature, and every family within the relevant social radius, had found a reason to attend.
Eleanor knew this world. She had grown up inside it, understood its textures and its protocols and its cruelties, the particular cruelty of a class that maintained its hierarchy through a thousand small signals, dress and posture, and the precise way you positioned yourself relative to others in a room.
She had never loved it. She had learned to navigate it the way you learn to navigate a road with bad footing carefully, with your weight distributed, never fully trusting the surface. She wore the gray silk, not the blue which her mother had requested, and not the brown wool, which would have been a repetition of a gesture already made. The gray silk was somewhere in between a dress she'd had for 2 years, well-fitted, unadorned, the kind of thing a woman wore when she wasn't trying to do anything in particular with her appearance, but had enough self-respect not to be careless about it. Her mother had looked at it when Eleanor came downstairs and said nothing, which meant she'd accepted the negotiation. The Aldridge house was loud and warm, and full of the specific energy of people performing their social standing for each other. Eleanor moved through it with the practiced ease of someone who had learned that the best way to be left alone was to appear purposeful, to move like you were going somewhere specific, which discouraged the kind of sideways conversation that tended to trap women at receptions for 45 minutes at a time. She found a corner near the window that offered a clear view of the room and stationed herself there with a glass of lemonade and her usual patient inventory. Cecily appeared beside her 10 minutes later.
He's here?
She said very quietly.
Eleanor had already seen him. He'd arrived with a man she didn't recognize, mid-30s lawyer's bearing, probably connected to whatever political business had brought the Duke to Boston. They'd come in through the main entry, and the room had reorganized around their arrival in the way that rooms did around men of considerable standing, people gravitating and then trying to look like they weren't gravitating. The Duke was scanning the room. Eleanor watched him do it. Watched his eyes move over the assembled company with the methodical patience of a man not looking for any particular thing. And then his eyes found her corner near the window and stopped. Even across the full width of the Aldridge drawing room, she felt it. He said something to the man beside him without looking at him. The man nodded, and the Duke began moving through the room.
He's coming over.
Cecily said with the controlled excitement of a woman who found this entire situation considerably more interesting than anything else available to her at the Aldridge reception.
I see that, Eleanor said.
What are you going to do?
Stand here, Eleanor said.
I'm quite good at it.
He reached her in just under 2 minutes, which was impressive, given the number of people who tried to intercept him along the way. He was gracious about it, a nod here. A few words there, a handshake with someone Eleanor recognized as a state legislator. But he didn't stop moving. He stopped in front of her.
Miss Whitmore.
His voice was even and warm, and contained something underneath it that she'd been trying to identify since the dinner table 2 nights ago. Attention. Genuine, unconditional attention, the kind that didn't require her to perform anything to sustain it.
Your Grace. She met his eyes. Page 47 was useful.
Something in his expression opened just slightly.
Was it?
The printer's note repositions the argument. If you read it against the third paragraph of Chapter 5, the contradiction I'd noticed becomes much more specific. It's not just that Locke fails to address persons classified as property. It's that he can't structurally. The argument collapses if he tries. He was quiet for a moment. Not surprised that wasn't quite right. More like a man who had offered something and had it returned with interest and was taking a moment to recalibrate.
Most people find that marginal note unremarkable, he said. Most people aren't reading for contradictions.
No, he agreed. They're not.
From across the room, Eleanor became aware of a particular quality of attention being directed at her corner, the attention of a social gathering that has identified something worth watching. She was familiar with that feeling. She'd generated it before, usually by saying something inappropriate at a dinner table. This was different. This was the attention that gathered around proximity to power, and the power was currently standing 2 feet away from her and talking about Locke.
She kept her eyes on his face and did not look around the room.
The man you came in with, she said.
He's your lawyer.
My solicitor. How did you know?
The way he listened when you spoke. Not like a friend, like a man tracking implications.
She took a small sip of her lemonade.
My father listens the same way when he's protecting something.
The Duke looked at her for a long moment.
Then, Harrington and Whitmore are apparently in a disagreement about the terms of a land contract in Western Massachusetts. You know that.
I know my father has been anxious about something for 3 weeks, Eleanor said.
I assumed it was connected to your visit.
The land question would explain it.
Your father didn't tell you.
My father rarely tells me anything directly. He thinks it's protective.
She paused.
It isn't particularly.
Something shifted in the Duke's expression.
Do you want to know the terms of the disagreement?
Eleanor blinked.
No man in her experience had ever offered to tell her the terms of a business disagreement on the basis that she might want to know them. It was such an unexpected sentence that for a moment she simply looked at him.
Yes, she said when she'd processed it.
I do, he told her.
Clearly, without condescension, without the editing that men performed when they translated business matters for women, the simplification, the softening, the strategic omissions. He told her the actual terms, the actual dispute, the actual stakes. The Harrington estate held a land grant from the colonial period that overlapped with Whitmore-purchased land in Berkshire County. The surveys disagreed. Both families claimed priority. The lawyers had been arguing about it for 18 months without resolution.
Eleanor listened, filed it, thought about it quickly against what she knew of her father's anxieties and his patterns of reaction.
My father will yield before the survey question is resolved, she said. He won't want the legal cost.
My solicitor said the same thing.
I disagreed with him.
Why?
Because I thought the more important question was whether the resolution was just not whether it was efficient.
He looked at her steadily.
Was I wrong?
About my father, no.
He'll yield.
She paused.
About which question matters more?
She met his eyes.
No, you weren't wrong.
They looked at each other across 2 feet of Aldridge drawing room air, while the assembled social machinery of Boston upper-class life continued its rotations around them, and something passed between them that Eleanor didn't have a word for and wasn't sure she wanted to name. Then a voice sharp and bright and carrying cut through the room's noise like a letter opener through an envelope.
Your Grace, surely you haven't been hiding in this corner all evening.
Eleanor turned. The woman approaching them was somewhere in her late 20s, fair-haired, wearing a gown the color of evening sky that had obviously been chosen with the specific intention of being noticed. She moved through the room with the practiced ease of someone who was never uncertain about her welcome. One hand extended toward the Duke with the automatic confidence of prior acquaintance.
Lady Harriet.
The Duke's voice was neutral in a way that was different from his usual neutralness. The warmth had been carefully extracted from it.
You're in Boston.
For the summer.
Cousin Frederick is here for the assembly sessions, and I simply couldn't bear another summer in Newport without more interesting company. She arrived in front of them, took the Duke's hand, and managed the greeting, before turning her eyes with the specific precision of a woman who has already assessed a situation and decided how to handle it to Eleanor. She looked at Eleanor the way certain women look at other women, the full inventory conducted in under 2 seconds, dress and hair and posture and social position, all catalogued and filed and judged, the result of the judgment visible only in the very slight shift of her expression, the almost imperceptible relaxation that meant not a threat. "And you are," Lady Harriet said, "pleasant, polished, the tiniest fraction dismissive." "Eleanor Whitmore," Eleanor said. "The Whitmores, the shipping family. Yes, I believe I know your mother." The slight emphasis on mother managed to communicate without saying anything impolite that knowing someone's mother was a very different matter from knowing someone of consequence. "How lovely to meet you." "Likewise," Eleanor said with the precise warmth appropriate to the moment, not cold, not warm, simply even, and felt the Duke's eyes on the side of her face. Lady Harriet turned back to the Duke with the easy repositioning of someone who understood how rooms worked, who the center of gravity was, and how to reclaim it. "We must catch up properly. Aunt Caroline has been asking after you, and I know she'd love to hear your thoughts on the Newport situation. Will you be there at all this summer?" "My plans are uncertain," the Duke said. "Oh, but you must. The summer is unbearable without the right company, and Boston charming as it is." The pause was barely perceptible, barely paudi, tends toward the commercial, which has its uses, I suppose. Eleanor heard what wasn't being said. She was supposed to hear it. That was the point. "The commercial," she said pleasantly, "tends to have the advantage of being useful. I can see the appeal of things that are merely decorative, but it does seem a limited ambition." Lady Harriet's eyes came back to her, sharp this time. The inventory had been reconducted, and the result had changed. "Miss Whitmore is from one of Boston's founding families," the Duke said into the small silence. His voice was calm and clear and public. "Her father's land holdings in western Massachusetts are among the oldest continuous grants in the state, and her knowledge of political philosophy would hold its own in most academic settings I've encountered." He looked at Eleanor. "Present company not excepted." Lady Harriet smiled. The smile did not reach anywhere close to her eyes. "How accomplished," she said. "Not especially," Eleanor said. "I just read things and pay attention. Most people can do it if they try." The silence this time was a full beat longer. Lady Harriet turned back to the Duke. "I hope you'll allow me to monopolize you for at least a portion of the evening. There's so much to discuss." She placed her hand on his arm, light proprietary, the gesture of a woman who has done this before and expects it to communicate something. "I'm sure Miss Whitmore will forgive us." "Of course," Eleanor said. The Duke looked at her. The look lasted just long enough to be deliberate. "I'll find you before the evening ends," he said. It was said clearly, in a register that was audible to Lady Harriet, in a register that was audible to the three people nearest to them who were very studiously not listening. Then he allowed himself to be moved away, Lady Harriet's hand still on his arm, her voice already running easily into whatever subject she'd selected, and Eleanor was left alone in her corner with her glass of lemonade and the full attention of a drawing room that had just witnessed something. Cecily appeared at her elbow within 30 seconds. "What just happened?" "A calibration," Eleanor said. "A what?" "He told her something," Eleanor said quietly. "In front of everyone, deliberately." She looked at her lemonade. "I'm trying to decide what to do with it." "What do you mean, what to do with it, Eleanor? The Duke of Ashford just publicly—" "I know what he did." Her voice came out quieter than she meant it to. "That's why I need to think about it." Because here was the thing that Eleanor understood, that she'd understood from the moment his eyes had found her corner, and he'd started moving through the room, that she'd understood all through the conversation about Locke and land grants, and the printer's note on page 47. She was not safe here. Not in the way she usually wasn't safe, the ordinary social danger of a woman who didn't comply with expectations. Something different. Something more specific. She was in danger of believing it. That was the real risk. Not that he would reject her. That he wouldn't. That this was exactly what it looked like. That the Duke of Ashford had spent 3 years remembering a 40-minute conversation in a Cambridge garden and had come to Boston and moved a chair and sent a book and just publicly claimed her attention in front of Lady Harriet, whoever she was, and the entire Aldridge drawing room, and that all of it meant what it appeared to mean. Eleanor had built very careful walls. She had built them out of the best materials available. Refusal argument. The brown wool dress. The habit of saying the inconvenient true thing instead of the comfortable useful thing. She had built them because she had understood from a young age that the worst thing that could happen to a woman with her particular kind of intelligence was to want something and be wrong about whether she could have it. She had never met anyone who made her feel like the walls might be poorly sighted. She was meeting him now. Across the room, the Duke was standing with Lady Harriet and a small cluster of men near the fireplace. His posture patient and his expression attentive, and even from this distance, Eleanor could see the thing she'd noticed at her own dinner table, the slight quality of absence in his manner when he was talking to people who didn't interest him, the way his mind kept its own counsel while his surface ran on social protocol. And then, as if she'd called to him without speaking, his eyes moved across the room and found her face. He held her gaze for 3 full seconds. Then he turned back to the conversation beside him. Eleanor looked down at her hands. "Cecily," she said. "Yes. I may have made a strategic error." Cecily looked at her sideways. "The dress? Not the dress." Eleanor paused. "I came downstairs yesterday prepared to repel him." "I know. I think I didn't account for the possibility that he wasn't coming to be repelled." She was quiet for a moment. "He was coming to find me. He already knew he was going to like me. I didn't have any defense against that because I didn't know it was the situation." Cecily was quiet beside her for a moment. Then, "Eleanor, what if that's not a strategic error?" Eleanor looked at her sister. "What if," Cecily said with the careful gentleness of someone navigating something fragile. "It's just what happened." Eleanor didn't have an answer to that. It was a sentence that bypassed all her usual response systems, the argument, the analysis, the careful inventory, and landed somewhere underneath them, somewhere softer and less defended, and sat there quietly waiting. She looked back across the room. He was still in conversation, still patient, still running his surface on protocol, while his mind did whatever it did behind those steady gray eyes. He didn't look back at her again. He'd said what he meant to say clearly and publicly, and he appeared to be content to let it stand. The evening continued around her. People talked and moved and performed their social calculations, and Eleanor stood in her corner with her lemonade and felt something shift in the architecture of herself slowly, like a house settling like walls that had been built too rigid, finally finding the pressure point and beginning very slightly to give. She did not tell herself to stop. That was the thing she noticed. She usually told herself to stop. This time, she didn't. Across the room, a woman she dimly recognized as Mrs. Aldridge, the hostess, a woman with the pleasant, inquisitive manner of someone who found everyone interesting, appeared beside Lady Harriet's group and drew several people away into a different conversation. The cluster reorganized. The Duke stepped back from it, and then he was crossing the room again. Not quickly. Not with any apparent urgency, just moving through the assembled company with the unhurried directness of a man who knew where he was going and didn't see the need to pretend otherwise. He stopped in front of Eleanor. "You didn't move," he said. "I was comfortable where I was." Most people would have moved, to see and be seen. He glanced around the room briefly, then back at her. "You stayed in the corner." "I can see the room from here," Eleanor said. "That's the important thing." He looked at her for a moment. "You're watching all of it." "I always am." "What do you see?" Eleanor considered the room. "Mrs. Aldridge is managing 4 separate anxieties simultaneously and doesn't want anyone to know she's anxious. The man by the punch bowl, the one in the green coat, is here to be seen by Senator Calloway rather than for any social reason. Your lawyer is watching you with the specific attention of a man who is revising his assessment of something. And Lady Harriet, she paused.
Go on, the Duke said.
Lady Harriet is performing ease for the room, Eleanor said carefully. She's very good at it. But she's watching your back from across the room, and the performance has a slight seam in it just there.
She didn't look toward Lady Harriet. She kept her eyes on the Duke's face. She expected this evening to go differently.
A short silence. Then, she expected me to be glad of familiar company after a week of new faces.
Were you?
He didn't answer immediately. When he did, his voice was quiet.
Not especially.
That's going to be a problem, Eleanor said. She's not accustomed to it.
I know.
He said it without apology.
That's been true for some time. It's not a new difficulty.
He paused.
What else do you see?
Eleanor looked up at him.
You're asking a lot of questions tonight.
I like the answers.
He held her gaze.
I've found in my experience that the person who watches the room correctly usually understands it better than anyone else in it.
And you watch the room correctly.
It was such a direct statement, not a compliment,
exactly.
Something more precise than a compliment. Something that named a specific thing she did, and recognized it as worthwhile. That for a moment Eleanor had nothing to say.
The walls shifted again.
That settling sound quiet and inevitable.
Your Grace, she started.
Alexander, he said.
She stopped, looked at him.
If you're willing, he said.
We've been talking about philosophy and land disputes and the internal politics of Boston drawing rooms for 3 days. I think we've passed the point where Your Grace is strictly necessary.
A slight pause.
Though I'll leave it to you.
Eleanor looked at him for a long moment, thought about rules, about walls, about what she'd told herself in the dark 2 nights ago.
Alexander, she said,
and watched something happen in his face. Not quite a smile. Something beneath that, something that made him look for just a moment like a man who had been very carefully controlled for a very long time, and had just in a room full of people allowed one thing to be true.
Thank you, he said quietly.
From across the room, Lady Harriet was watching them. Eleanor knew it without looking. She could feel it the way you feel weather coming before it arrives, the particular pressure of it, the shift in the air. She kept her eyes on Alexander's face and thought about the women in this room who move through the world on charm and connection and careful social performance, who shaped their personalities to be wanted, who dressed for reception and calibrated their opinions for approval, who had been trained since childhood to make themselves available to be chosen. And she thought about a brown wool dress on a July morning, about a choice she'd made from exhaustion and refusal, about walking downstairs without performing a single thing, and finding at the bottom of it a man who had already known who she was.
You came to Boston for the land dispute, she said.
Partly, he said.
She looked at him.
I knew you were here, he said simply.
I've known for 2 years. Your cousin's family mentioned it in correspondence.
He paused.
I didn't come specifically, but I didn't avoid it either.
The room breathed around them. People talked and laughed, and the punch bowl was replenished, and the evening performed all its usual functions. Indifferent to the conversation happening in a corner near a window, where a woman in gray silk was learning slowly and with considerable internal resistance, that the walls she'd built might have been keeping out something she'd actually wanted.
Why didn't you write? She said.
Not accusatory.
A genuine question.
Because I didn't know if you'd remember me.
His voice was even.
And because what I remembered of you suggested that a man who simply wrote without cause would not be well received.
Despite herself, Eleanor almost smiled.
You're not wrong.
I know.
A slight pause.
Was I right to wait?
The question was direct and clear, and asked without the maneuvering she'd become accustomed to from men who wanted things from her. It was simply the question offered plainly, with the steady gray patience of a man who would accept whatever answer she gave.
Eleanor thought about the next 3 days.
About Thursday, about the book on her writing desk, with the marginal note on page 47, about her mother and the blue silk, and everything that had already been set in motion around her, without her permission. She thought about what it would mean to answer honestly.
Yes, she said. He was quiet for a moment. Then he nodded once, the nod of a man filing something in a permanent place.
Then I'll be in Boston for the remainder of the month, he said, if that's convenient.
Eleanor looked at him.
It's not inconvenient, she said.
And that she thought the understatement, the measured yield, the tiniest controlled opening of something she'd been holding shut for a long time, was probably as honest as she'd been about anything in years. Outside, the Boston summer continued its humid work. Inside, the Aldridge reception continued its rotations. And in a corner near the window, two people who had been finding each other for 3 years stood 6 inches closer together than the social conventions of 1815 strictly required, and neither of them moved away. Lady Harriet Voss left the Aldridge reception that night without saying goodbye to anyone who mattered, which was how Eleanor knew the evening had gone worse for her than it had appeared. She heard about it the next morning from an unexpected source. Not Cecily, not her mother, not the usual channels through which Boston society information traveled. The information came from Mrs. Porter, a neighbor of some standing, who arrived at the Whitmore house at 10 in the morning on a social call that had very little to do with being social, who sat in the parlor with Margaret Whitmore and a cup of tea and said with the careful pleasure of a woman delivering news she knew would land with weight that Lady Harriet Voss had apparently told 3 separate people at the Aldridge reception that Eleanor Whitmore was precisely the sort of woman that men of the Duke's position found temporarily amusing and ultimately unsuitable. Eleanor heard this from the hallway. She had not been invited to the parlor for Mrs. Porter's call. She was standing in the hallway with a book under her arm on her way to the back garden, and she stopped walking when she heard her name. She stood there for a moment, listened to the full sentence, processed the specific word amusing, and understood exactly what it was designed to do. It was designed to be repeated, to travel from Mrs. Porter to her mother, to wherever it traveled next, spreading its particular implication through the social network, like water through sand, quiet and pervasive and nearly invisible. Temporarily amusing, ultimately unsuitable. Eleanor looked at the book under her arm, the 1713 lock which she'd been carrying around for 2 days like a stone. She couldn't put down and thought very deliberately about what she was going to do with what she'd just heard. The parlor door was slightly open. She could hear her mother's silence on the other side of it, which was louder, in some ways, than anything Mrs. Porter had said. Margaret Whitmore, in silence, was a woman doing rapid calculations. Eleanor had learned to read the quality of her mother's silence, the way sailors read water, the stillness that meant nothing was happening, versus the stillness that meant something was about to. She pushed the parlor door open and walked in. Mrs. Porter looked up with the expression of someone whose private conversation has been interrupted and isn't sure yet whether to be annoyed about it. Her mother looked at her with the expression of someone who has just had a problem they haven't solved yet walk into the room.
I heard, Eleanor said pleasantly, and sat down in the chair nearest the window. Lady Harriet Voss.
Eleanor, her mother started. I'm not upset, Eleanor said. Which was true. She wasn't upset. She was something else. Alert. Precise the quality of attention she got when a problem presented itself clearly enough to examine. She's entitled to her opinion. I'm just curious what she hoped would happen when she said it. Mrs. Porter, recovering her composure with the speed of a woman experienced in social turbulence, produced a small, careful smile.
I'm sure it was said without malice, dear. Lady Harriet is a woman of great feeling. She speaks quickly.
She spoke quickly 3 separate times to 3 separate people, Eleanor said.
That's not quickness. That's strategy.
Silence. Eleanor looked at Mrs. Porter.
What else did she say?
Another pause. The woman across from her was recalibrating. Eleanor could see it, the slight shift in her posture that meant she'd arrived expecting to speak to Margaret Whitmore and found herself in a different conversation entirely. She expressed concern. Mrs. Porter said carefully that the Duke's attention might be misunderstood by some parties. By me specifically.
I don't think she named...
She named me, Eleanor said. You were going to tell my mother the specific name. I walked in before you got there. She was quiet for a moment. What is Lady Harriet to the Duke exactly beyond acquaintance? Mrs. Porter looked at Margaret. Margaret looked at Mrs. Porter.
The look exchanged between them communicated something that Eleanor was supposed to be too naive or too obtuse to read. She read it perfectly. She expected to marry him, Eleanor said. Her mother closed her eyes briefly. Mrs. Porter made a sound that wasn't quite a denial. Not formally. Eleanor continued working through it with the same methodical precision she applied to philosophical arguments. No arrangement was made, but there was an understanding, or she believed there was, and the Duke's behavior at the Aldridge reception contradicted that understanding in a public setting. And now she's managing the fallout by positioning me as the explanation. She paused. That's what the temporarily amusing is doing. It's telling the room not to read too much into what they saw, because what they saw is a distraction, not a development. The parlor was very quiet. Mrs. Porter was looking at Eleanor with an expression that had moved past social calculation into something closer to genuine assessment. You are, she said slowly, a very particular young woman, Miss Whitmore. So I've been told, Eleanor said. After Mrs. Porter left earlier than she'd planned, Eleanor judged, given the trajectory of the visit, her mother sat in the parlor and looked at her eldest daughter with an expression that Eleanor had rarely seen on her face. It wasn't anger. It wasn't the controlled frustration that Margaret Whitmore usually directed at Eleanor's refusals and corrections. It was something more complicated. Something that looked, if Eleanor was reading it correctly, like a woman revising an assessment she'd held for 20 years. You knew all of that, Margaret said. Just from what I heard you say in the hallway. I had context, Eleanor said. The Duke told me about the land dispute. That gave me a framework for understanding his movements. He told you? Her mother said it flatly. About the business dispute. Yes. He didn't tell your father everything about it. Your father has been trying to get the full picture for 3 weeks. Eleanor looked at her mother. Didn't say anything. Margaret stood and crossed to the window and looked out at the street. When she spoke, her voice was quieter than Eleanor was accustomed to. I've managed this family for 23 years, she said. I've made decisions I believed were correct. About how to present you. About what was required. She paused. I may have, in some cases, managed things in ways that didn't serve you as well as they served the appearance. Eleanor was very still. The blue silk, her mother said. The table arrangements. The... She stopped. Didn't finish. I thought you needed to be managed differently. I didn't consider that you might know something I didn't. It was the closest Margaret Whitmore had come to an apology in Eleanor's memory. It was so close and arrived so quietly that for a moment Eleanor didn't know what to do with it. Mother, she said. Don't make it sentimental, Margaret said, turning from the window with the brisk efficiency of a woman who has allowed herself one moment of softness and is now closing it. What are you going to do about Lady Harriet Voss? Eleanor thought about it. Nothing, she said. Nothing. She's managing a disappointment. If I respond, I make it a competition. I'm not competing, she paused. What she said about me temporarily amusing, ultimately unsuitable. The only thing that makes that a problem is if the Duke agrees with it. And I can't determine whether he does by winning a social skirmish with Lady Harriet. I can only determine it by... She stopped. By what? Her mother asked. By being exactly who I am, Eleanor said, and finding out. He called on Friday. Not through her father. Not through the formal channels that a man of his position would normally use the letter sent ahead, the appointment made the careful orchestration of access. He arrived at the Whitmore door at 2 in the afternoon and asked with the calm directness she was beginning to recognize as simply how he operated whether Miss Whitmore was available for a walk. Her mother, who answered the door herself because both maids were in the kitchen, looked at Eleanor over the Duke's shoulder with an expression that said several things simultaneously. Eleanor put down the book and got her light shawl from the hook by the door and went. The streets of Beacon Hill in July heat had a particular quality, the brick holding warmth, the air thick and still between the buildings, the sounds of the city present, but muffled, as if the heat were absorbing some of the noise. Eleanor walked beside Alexander Harrington and felt the strangeness of it.
the particular strangeness of being next to someone your body had decided to trust before your mind had finished the argument. I heard about what Lady Harriet said. He told her about a block from her house. No preamble, no approach from the side.
How? Eleanor asked.
Because she said it to enough people that it came back to me by Thursday evening. He paused. I want you to know that I intend to address it.
You don't need to, Eleanor said.
I know I don't need to.
His voice was even.
I'm choosing to.
Alexander!
She stopped walking. He stopped beside her. She looked up at him directly the way she looked at things she needed to see clearly.
What Lady Harriet said is going to be repeated regardless. In 3 days, it will be in every parlor in the relevant social radius. Addressing it formally makes it larger, not smaller.
I'm not planning to address it formally.
Something moved in his expression, not quite impatience, something beneath that, something more personal.
I'm planning to make it irrelevant.
By doing what?
By continuing to do exactly what I've been doing, he said.
Which is spending my time where I want to spend it.
He held her gaze.
The question is whether that's acceptable to you, given the position it puts you in.
Eleanor thought about Mrs. Porter in the parlor, about the word amusing, about a woman in an evening sky gown watching the back of a man who had moved a chair without asking and sent a book before breakfast.
It's acceptable, she said.
He nodded. They started walking again.
Tell me about Wollstonecraft, he said.
The second reading. What did you find in the third chapter that the first reading missed?
And just like that, they were back in the conversation. The one that had been running Eleanor was beginning to understand since a garden in Cambridge 3 years ago, interrupted by time and distance and the particular architecture of a world that put men and women in separate rooms and expected them to communicate through intermediaries. The conversation that apparently hadn't stopped just because neither of them had been continuing it out loud. She told him about the third chapter. He listened with the quality of attention she'd come to expect from him. Not polite attention, real attention, the kind that asked follow-up questions that went somewhere, instead of the kind that nodded at intervals and waited for its turn to speak. They walked for 2 hours. When they came back to the Whitmore house, they stood at the front steps, and Eleanor realized she couldn't account for where the time had gone, which had not happened to her in conversation with another person since she was 15 years old, and arguing with her father about the economics of the slave trade until her mother separated them for dinner.
Tomorrow, he said.
It wasn't quite a question.
I'll be here, she said.
He left.
She went inside.
Bess was at the top of the stairs with wide eyes. Her mother was somewhere in the back of the house giving the appearance of being occupied with something domestic that she was not actually occupied with. And Eleanor went to her room and sat at her desk and looked at the lock and thought about what it meant that she'd just agreed to see him tomorrow without a single internal argument. The walls were giving. She could feel it. Not collapsing, she didn't collapse. It wasn't how she was built, but settling. Adjusting. Becoming something with doors in it, instead of just height. She wasn't sure yet whether to be frightened. She opened the book to page 47, and read the marginal note again. She wasn't frightened, she decided. She was something else. Something that didn't have a precise word that lived in the space between recognition and consequence, between understanding what was happening and knowing what it would cost. She was paying attention. That was what she was doing. And she had always believed that paying attention genuinely and without the distortions of hope or fear was the most honest thing a person could do. She was paying attention to Alexander Harrington. And what she was finding quietly carefully with all her usual resistance was that she liked what she saw. The Whitmore garden party was her mother's idea. Eleanor found out about it on Saturday morning, 3 days after the Aldridge reception, when she came downstairs to find Margaret in the kitchen with the cook going through quantities for a gathering of 20 that had apparently been conceived, planned, and partially organized between Thursday evening and Saturday breakfast.
You're hosting a party, Eleanor said from the kitchen doorway.
An informal gathering, her mother said without turning from the discussion of cold meats. Next Wednesday. The weather should hold.
Who's invited?
A slight pause.
The Aldridges, the Porters,
Senator Calloway and his wife, the Wentworths. Another pause. The Duke, if he's available.
Eleanor looked at her mother's back. This is a dinner party built around inviting the Duke. It's a gathering of people who have expressed interest in spending time together.
Mother, Margaret turned. There was color in her face that wasn't entirely attributable to the kitchen heat.
I am trying, she said carefully, to create a context, a proper one, one that serves you well instead of requiring you to perform at other people's gatherings where the rules aren't ours. She paused.
Your corner at the Aldridges, your gray silk. You stood in that corner for 3 hours and came home having apparently established something significant, but you did it in Harriet Aldridge's house with Harriet Aldridge's rules. This would be our house.
Eleanor looked at her.
I'm learning, her mother said simply.
Eleanor said nothing for a moment. Then she said, invite him. She turned and went back upstairs. She didn't tell her mother that the idea was actually not a bad one. She didn't need to. Margaret Whitmore would figure it out herself.
So, Alexander accepted the invitation by return message on Saturday afternoon, which meant he'd replied within an hour of receiving it.
Eleanor noticed this and filed it. He arrived on Sunday for another walk, a pattern establishing itself without discussion, without arrangement, simply by continuation, and she told him about the gathering and watched his face.
Your mother organized this, he said.
She did.
She's changing her approach.
She's pragmatic, Eleanor said.
She saw that the earlier approach wasn't working, and she's adjusting.
She paused.
That's one of her better qualities, actually. She doesn't hold on to strategies that fail.
He looked at her sideways.
You're more generous to her than I expected.
She's difficult, Eleanor said.
She's also not wrong that certain things are easier in certain contexts. The gathering will be on our ground. That matters.
She paused.
Don't read more into the generosity. She arranged the table to put me at the wrong end. I haven't forgotten.
Something that was almost a laugh passed across his face.
Almost. He didn't quite get there, but it was close enough that Eleanor felt it like a temperature change.
She wanted suddenly, with an urgency that surprised her, to know what his laugh actually sounded like. Whether it was the sound of a controlled man briefly losing control, or something easier than that. Something that meant the control had finally found somewhere it didn't need to be maintained. She looked away before he could catch her thinking it.
Lady Harriet is leaving Boston, he said.
Eleanor glanced at him.
When?
She mentioned it last evening. I saw her at a dinner at the Calloway house. She said her cousin's business has concluded, and she'll return to Newport by the end of next week.
He paused. She was composed about it, more than I expected.
She's good at composure, Eleanor said. We've established that.
She asked about you, he said.
Eleanor stopped walking.
What did she ask? Whether I thought you were serious.
He stopped beside her.
Those were her exact words. Whether I thought you were serious.
She implied that women who make a habit of unconventional behavior often do so because they haven't found a reason to behave conventionally yet, and that the right circumstances change the pattern.
Eleanor was very still.
She implied that I'm performing the unconventional the same way she performs the conventional.
Yes, Eleanor thought about this. Took it seriously the way she took things seriously, without the defensive dismissal that would have been easier. She turned it over and looked at its undersides.
Is she wrong? She said.
The question surprised him. She could see at the brief shift in his expression.
I think, he said carefully, that the answer is no. I think the difference between you and Lady Harriet is exactly what I'd expect from the difference in your philosophies she performs for acceptance, and you refuse performance even at personal cost. Those are not the same position.
He paused. But I find it worth noting that you asked.
Why?
Because most people don't.
He looked at her steadily.
Most people, when offered a criticism, either accept it completely or reject it completely. You held it up and looked at it. That's...
He stopped.
What? Rare, he said.
In my experience, that's genuinely rare. They started walking again.
Eleanor felt something move in her chest. Not the wall this time, something on the other side of the wall. Something that had been waiting there quietly for a long time, and was only now becoming audible. She had been, she realized, very lonely. Not in the surface way, she had her sister, she had her books, she had the running argument with the world that kept her company well enough. But in the specific way of a person who has never been able to say the complete thought, because there was never anyone present who could hold the full weight of it. She had been lonely for someone who could hold the full weight. She didn't say any of this. She wasn't ready to say it. But she thought it clearly and honestly, and let it be true.
Wednesday, Alexander said. Your mother's gathering.
Wednesday, she confirmed. I'll be there.
I know, she said.
Wednesday arrived with the kind of morning that made promises. The afternoon sometimes didn't keep cool at breakfast. A breeze from the harbor, the quality of light that suggested the heat might hold off long enough to make an outdoor gathering genuinely pleasant. By noon, Eleanor's mother had the back garden arranged with the efficiency of a woman who had been organizing social occasions since before Eleanor was born, and by 2 o'clock, the first guests were arriving. The Aldridges came first, then the Porters. The Wentworths arrived together and separated immediately upon entry, which told its own story. Senator Calloway came with his wife and a young aide, who looked too young for the occasion, and spent the first 20 minutes near the lemonade table trying to look like he was supposed to be there. The Duke arrived at 2:30. Eleanor was standing with Cecily near the rose beds when she heard the front door and felt the subtle reorganization of the party's energy that she'd come to recognize as his effect on a room, or in this case, a garden. Conversation redistributed. People shifted their positions with the casual deliberateness of those who believe themselves unobserved. She kept her attention on Cecily. He found her in under 3 minutes. She was beginning to think he could locate her by some mechanism. She didn't have a name for some specific register of attention that didn't require line of sight.
Miss Whitmore, he said, arriving beside her.
The formal address they were in public there were eyes.
Your Grace.
She turned. He looked well, which she noted with the interior irritation of a woman who didn't want to be noting it. Simply well, the ease of a man who had slept properly, whose mind was running at its full capacity, whose attention was entirely present. You're not performing hostess duties, he observed. My mother is performing them. She does it better than I would.
I saw her. She seems...
He paused, different from the dinner. She's adjusting, Eleanor said. This is her ground. She moves better on her own ground. He considered this with the brief internal filing she'd learned to recognize the slight pause that meant he was cataloging something for later.
The garden is well managed, he said without looking at the garden. My father manages it, one of his few domestic interests.
She paused. He'll want to talk to you about the land dispute.
I know.
He glanced toward where Thomas Whitmore stood with Senator Calloway.
I've already decided to resolve it in his favor.
Eleanor turned to look at him fully.
Why?
Because the original survey is ambiguous enough that a court would take another 18 months to decide, and the cost to both families wouldn't justify the outcome.
He paused. And because I believe in resolving things cleanly when I can.
When did you decide?
Last week.
He met her eyes. After our conversation about which question matters more. Eleanor looked at him. Something about that, the directness of it, the acknowledgement that she had influenced something real, not just that she'd been charming or interesting or amusing, landed somewhere very specific inside her. Not in the walls. Below the walls. In whatever she actually was underneath all the defense.
You should tell him soon, she said. He's been worried about it.
I'll find the moment, he said. Across the garden, she saw Lady Harriet. The recognition arrived in her chest, like cold water, sudden sharp breathtaking. Because Lady Harriet Voss was not supposed to be here. Lady Harriet was supposed to be leaving Boston, was supposed to have been effectively removed from this particular equation by geography and timing and the quiet conclusion of the Calloway dinner. And yet there she was, near the lemonade table, wearing a dress the color of cream.
and speaking to Mrs. Wentworth with a smile that showed every tooth. Eleanor said very quietly, "She's here." Alexander didn't turn immediately. "I see her," he said. "Did you know she'd been invited?" A pause. "No, my mother didn't know either," Eleanor said, processing rapidly. "She wouldn't have invited her, which means someone else." She stopped, looked across the garden at her father standing with Senator Calloway, thought about what Lady Harriet's cousin had been in Boston for, business connected to the legislature, and Senator Calloway was at this party, and he'd arrived with his aide and Lady Harriet apparently in some kind of related orbit. "Senator Calloway," she said. "His aide brought her," Alexander said quietly. "I understand now. She's connected to the Calloway political network. He'd have included her without understanding the complication." Eleanor kept her face entirely composed. Around them, the party continued its pleasant rotations. Cecily had drifted toward the young aide near the lemonade, because Cecily was excellent at finding the useful position in a social situation without appearing to. Her mother was with the Aldridges, and had not yet seen, or if she had seen, was managing it with the practiced composure of a woman who had been managing unexpected guests for decades. "She's going to come over," Eleanor said. "Give her 3 minutes." "Two," Alexander said. It was 90 seconds. Lady Harriet moved through the garden with the ease of a woman in an environment she'd decided to own, stopping for brief exchanges as she moved, building her path toward them with the social grace of someone who had been taught since childhood how to cross a room without looking like you were crossing toward anything in particular. She arrived. "Your Grace." She gave him the smile, first warm, intimate, freighted with prior acquaintance. Then she turned to Eleanor.
"Miss Whitmore, what a lovely gathering."
The pause was a full quarter second longer than politeness required.
"Your mother is so clever with these informal entertainments."
"She is," Eleanor agreed. "I do hope," Lady Harriet continued with the light, pleasant tone of a woman saying something pointed in the most gracious possible register, "that this summer in Boston hasn't been too taxing for either of you." The either landing with specific weight, the implication clear, she was acknowledging them as a unit, and acknowledging the unit as something that would have a conclusion.
"Not at all," Alexander said. His voice was perfectly even.
"I find Boston considerably more interesting than I anticipated." Lady Harriet's eyes moved to Eleanor.
"And you, Miss Whitmore, you must find all this social activity rather different from your usual quieter pursuits."
"I read philosophy," Eleanor said pleasantly.
"The social activity is a fairly natural extension." Lady Harriet's smile held.
"Fascinating hobby.
I've always found that women who read very seriously tend to use it as a sort of fortress, I suppose. A way of being unavailable." She tilted her head slightly.
"Not a criticism, of course. Simply an observation."
The garden moved around them. Birds somewhere. The sound of conversation. Nothing changed in the surface of the party. Eleanor looked at Lady Harriet. She looked at her with the full, direct attention she usually reserved for philosophical arguments, not hostile, not warm, simply clear.
"I've found the opposite," she said.
"Reading seriously tends to make a person more available. You understand what's actually being said, rather than what's merely being performed." She paused.
"It's useful in conversations like this one."
A silence. Short. Sharp. Lady Harriet's smile thinned by a fraction. Then she turned to Alexander and said with the smooth gear shift of a woman who has encountered unexpected resistance and is changing approach. "I wanted to say before I leave Boston, and I do leave by Thursday, I'm afraid that I hope whatever business has brought you here resolves itself simply. You deserve a clean conclusion." The word conclusion landing with the same specific weight as either had landed a moment ago. "Things have a way of concluding clearly," Alexander said, "when you're honest about what you want." Lady Harriet looked at him for a long moment. Something crossed her face, not the social mask, something underneath it, something real and briefly unguarded. Eleanor saw it. She looked away from it because it was private, and she was not in the habit of watching private things.
"Of course," Lady Harriet said.
then to Eleanor with a shift in tone so small it was almost undetectable, almost, but not quite, "Enjoy the summer, Miss Whitmore." She moved away, smooth, controlled, every inch of her composure intact. Eleanor let out a breath she hadn't known she was holding. "You were right," Alexander said quietly. "She's good at composure. She's also," Eleanor said carefully, "not entirely wrong about everything." She paused. "The fortress comment. About women who read seriously." She was quiet for a moment. "I have used it that way, the reading. As a way of being unavailable." He didn't say anything. Waited. "I'm trying," Eleanor said, "to use it differently now." She looked up at him. "As a way of understanding what's actually happening, instead of what I'm afraid is happening." He looked at her steadily. "And what's actually happening?" The garden was full of people. 20 of them more or less spread across the Whitmore garden in the soft afternoon light, talking about commerce and legislation and the latest social news from Philadelphia. Her mother was moving through them with the skill of a woman in her own house. Her father was deep in conversation with Senator Calloway. Cecily had somehow gotten the young aide laughing at something which was a small domestic miracle, and Eleanor Whitmore was standing in the middle of all of it, looking at a man who had spent 3 years carrying a 40-minute conversation and had come to Boston and made his intentions clear in every way available to him without once asking her to perform a single thing she wasn't. "Something that doesn't have a word yet," she said, "but I think it's going to need one, to need." He was quiet for a moment. Then the thing that was almost a laugh came closer than it had before, closer than almost, and she heard it finally. Just barely a sound that was warm and private and entirely unlike anything she'd imagined. Something that wasn't controlled at all. She kept her face composed with an effort that she suspected would have been obvious to anyone paying attention. "Eleanor," he said. Her name in his voice, simply without the title quiet enough that no one around them would have heard it. "I'm going to resolve the land dispute with your father today. And I'm going to tell him that I intend to call on you formally. And I'm going to ask whether that's acceptable before I tell him." Her heart did something she would later describe to herself only as irregular. "You're telling me first," she said. "I'm asking you first," he said. "There's a difference." The afternoon held perfectly still around her. The breeze from the harbor. The sound of her mother graciously redirecting a conversation. The smell of the garden in summer, the particular thick warm smell of July in Boston roses, and warm brick, and the distant salt of the sea. She had come downstairs in a brown wool dress 10 days ago, prepared to refuse everything. "Yes," she said. "It's acceptable." He nodded once. The nod of a man putting something in a permanent place. Then he said, "I'll find your father," and moved across the garden with the unhurried directness that was simply how he moved through the world. Eleanor stood in the July afternoon and felt the walls finish their long, slow settling and become something entirely different. Not gone, she was not a woman without walls. She would always have walls, but changed. Permeable. Built now with windows in them, and at least one door that opened from the inside. Cecily appeared at her elbow. "He's going to talk to Father," Cecily said. "I know." "You said yes." "I did." Cecily was quiet for a moment. Eleanor could feel her sister trying to decide whether to say the thing she was thinking. "Are you frightened?" Cecily asked finally. Eleanor thought about it honestly. The way she thought about everything. "Yes," she said. "Of what?" Eleanor watched Alexander Harrington cross the garden toward her father and thought about a marginal note on page 47 and 2 hours walking in the summer heat and the specific sound of something that had almost been a laugh and then finally wasn't almost. "Of being right," she said quietly. "I've been wrong about so many things for so long that being right about something this large feels larger than I know how to hold." Cecily took her hand. Didn't say anything. Just held it. Eleanor let her. Across the garden, she watched the moment her father turned to see the Duke approaching him with the particular directness of a man who has made a decision and is done deferring. She watched her father's expression shift confusion, then calculation, then something that moved very quickly through his face that she'd never seen there before. Something that looked like relief. The two men shook hands. Eleanor looked at her sister's fingers wrapped around hers and thought that the worst thing that could have happened to her this summer was that she'd have come downstairs in the right dress and met the wrong man and played the right game and won the wrong prize. Instead, she had worn the worst dress she owned, and she was beginning to understand with a clarity that required no philosophical framework, no argument, no marginal note. In an old edition of anything, she was beginning to understand that the worst dress had been the most honest thing she'd ever worn, and that honesty offered into the right room had a way of finding its way home. Her father didn't come to her directly. That was the first thing Eleanor noticed when the garden party began its slow dissolution into late afternoon. The way Thomas Whitmore moved through the remaining guests with the deliberate case of a man managing something internally, nodding and laughing at the right moments. Refilling glasses, he didn't need to refill himself, finding reasons to be on the far side of the garden from where Eleanor was standing. He was avoiding her, not with hostility. With something that looked from a distance like a man who had been handed more than he'd expected and was trying to figure out how to carry it, Alexander left at 5. He shook her father's hand again at the door, spoke briefly with her mother. Eleanor watched Margaret's face during that exchange and saw the precise moment her mother understood the full weight of what had just happened to her family, and then found Eleanor near the garden gate and said simply, "Tomorrow." And that was all. Tomorrow, she agreed. He left. The garden emptied. The cook collected the remaining food. Bess and the other maid cleared the tables with the efficient quiet of women who understood that something significant had occurred in this house and were giving it room. Eleanor went upstairs. She didn't go to her room. She went to the small sitting room on the second floor. The room nobody used much, where her father kept older books. He no longer read, and where the afternoon light came through the west window in a long, warm bar, and she sat in the chair by the window and held the lock in her lap without opening it, and waited. She knew her father would come eventually. It was just a question of when he finished deciding what he wanted to say. He knocked 40 minutes later, which told her something he'd knocked rather than simply entering, which was not his usual approach to rooms where his daughters were sitting. She said, "Come in," and he did. Thomas Whitmore was the man who had been considered handsome in his youth and had aged into something more interesting. The handsomeness settling into character. His face carrying more of his history now than it had when he was young. He was 61, and he moved like a man who had spent decades in rooms where things were decided with the particular quality of presence that came from long practice at being listened to. Eleanor had inherited his eyes. She'd inherited the way he thought too, the methodical inventory, the refusal to accept a surface answer when the real question was still live. He had never, to her knowledge, known quite what to do with having produced a daughter who thought the way he did. He sat in the other chair, the one across the window. They looked at each other the way they'd been looking at each other since Eleanor was 12 and had beaten him at chess for the first time, and they'd both understood without saying it that something had shifted. "The Duke spoke to me," her father said. "I know," Eleanor said. "He told me he wants to call on you formally, that he intends to pursue courtship." He paused. "He also resolved the land dispute in our favor before he said any of it." "I know about that too," Eleanor said. Her father looked at her steadily. "He told you?" "He tells me things," Eleanor said. "Real things. That's been unusual in my experience." Thomas Whitmore was quiet for a moment. He looked at his daughter with the expression of a man taking an honest inventory of something he'd been imprecise about for a long time. "I should have told you about the land dispute," he said finally. You might have had useful thoughts." "I did have useful thoughts," Eleanor said. "He asked me about them." Another silence. Her father's face moved through something complicated, not quite guilt. Something adjacent to it, the expression of a man who has just understood that his management of a situation left a gap large enough for someone else to walk through. "You've been talking to him," he said. "Not just at the dinner. After."
He's called 3 times. We've walked twice.
She paused.
You knew he was calling. Mother knew.
I knew, he said. I thought I wasn't sure what to think.
He leaned back in the chair. The chair made a sound that was very familiar to Eleanor. The specific creak of that chair under her father's particular weight, a sound from her childhood.
Eleanor, I have not always. I have managed this family with the tools I had. Your mother is better at some of it than I am. I am better at some things than she is. Between us, we have produced a household that functions.
He paused.
I am not certain we have always produced something that was also fair.
Eleanor looked at him.
No, she said. Not always.
He accepted that without defense.
That was one of the things she respected about him. He didn't defend the indefensible, he just sat with it.
The Duke asked me, he said, whether you'd been given the choice, whether the dinner, whether you had understood it was a courtship occasion before he arrived.
He paused.
I told him the truth,
which was
that your mother had told you who was coming, that you had chosen to make your position clear.
He said it with the specific delicacy of a man choosing not to say you wore the wrong dress on purpose, because saying it plainly would require him to confront what it meant that she'd needed to.
He said he was glad.
He said the brown dress was the reason he stayed 2 hours.
Eleanor felt something catch in her chest.
He told you about the dress.
He said, and I'm giving you his exact words, because they are not words I would have reached on my own. He said that in 3 years of social obligations and strategic gatherings, he had never seen a woman walk into a room refusing to perform for him, and that it was the most honest thing anyone had done in his presence since he couldn't remember when.
Her father paused.
He said he'd been waiting for honest.
Eleanor looked at the lock in her lap, the worn spine, the foxed pages, the marginal note she now had nearly memorized.
Are you going to tell me to be careful? She said.
No, her father said,
which surprised her.
I was going to. I had the speech arranged.
About men of great position, and the complications of expectations, and the importance of not allowing yourself to...
He stopped.
And then I thought about the fact that you have been telling me various things for the past 6 years, and I have been managing you instead of listening, and I decided the speech was the wrong approach.
Eleanor looked at him directly.
What is the right approach?
Asking you, he said. What do you actually think of him? The question sat between them in the afternoon light, clean and simple and utterly unlike anything her father had asked her before.
Not what should you think? Not what do the circumstances require? Not how does this serve the family?
Just what do you think?
Eleanor took a breath.
I think, she said carefully, that he is the first person I have met in my adult life who has not required me to be smaller in order to be acceptable to him.
She paused.
I think he is intelligent and honest and considerably more careful than he appears. I think he has spent a great deal of his life in rooms where he was the most powerful person present and has found it on the whole lonely.
She looked at the window.
I think he came to Boston to find me specifically. Not in a frightening way, in the way of a man who knew what he wanted and went toward it.
Her father was quiet.
And I think, Eleanor said more quietly, that this is not something I'm approaching with my usual defenses intact. And that frightens me considerably, because my defenses have served me well.
They have, her father said.
They've also.
He stopped.
Also what?
Also cost you, he said.
Some things.
I've watched that.
He looked at her with the eyes she'd inherited, the same methodical gray.
The right defenses, he said, are the ones you can choose to lower, not the ones that never come down regardless of circumstance.
Eleanor looked at her father, really looked at him.
Not the father she'd been arguing with since she was 12, not the man she'd been managing her relationship to for years, not the figure who represented the household's authority and its failures. The person underneath all of that, who was she saw for the first time with real clarity trying.
All right, she said.
He nodded, started to rise, stopped.
Eleanor.
Yes,
the land dispute.
He paused.
He resolved it generously, more than generously.
The terms favored us in ways he didn't have to accept. I asked him why.
What did he say?
He said that the question of which resolution was just mattered more to him than which was strategically advantageous.
Her father paused.
He said a woman he respected had told him the same thing, and he'd decided she was correct.
Eleanor looked at the lock in her lap and felt in the center of her chest something that had been very carefully locked for a very long time give way without making any sound at all.
Good,
she said. Her voice was even. Her father left. Eleanor sat in the west window light until it went amber, and then pink, and then gray, and she thought about walls that had windows in them now, and doors that opened from the inside, and what it meant to have been right about something this large. It meant, she decided, that she was going to have to learn a new kind of courage. The kind that didn't require resistance. The kind that required simply walking forward. She wasn't certain she knew how to do that. She was going to try.
The formal calling began the following Monday, and Boston noticed immediately. This was inevitable. Boston's social network in the summer of 1815 functioned with the efficiency of a well-maintained mill information fed in at one end, and came out processed and distributed within 48 hours. The Duke of Ashford calling formally on the Whitmore household was not a small piece of information. It was the kind of information that reorganized other information around it that caused people to revisit conversations they'd had and reassess conclusions they'd reached. Mrs. Porter called on Tuesday with a social agenda that was three layers deep. On the surface, she was inquiring after Margaret's health. One layer down, she was gathering information. At the bottom, Eleanor understood she was recalibrating her position relative to the Whitmore family, which had suddenly become considerably more interesting than it had been a fortnight ago. Eleanor was not present for this call. She was in the back garden with the lock, and a second book she'd requested through Alexander, a volume on natural rights theory by a Virginia scholar she hadn't been able to locate in Boston's booksellers. He'd sent it with a note that said, "Only chapter 4 will make you argue with the page, which I find is the sign of something worth reading." He'd been right. She'd written three pages of objections in her private journal before breakfast. She heard Mrs. Porter arrive. She heard the particular social register of the conversation through the open window, the warmth, the careful probing her mother's responses, which were gracious and revealed almost nothing specific, which was its own kind of answer. And she heard at one point her mother say, with the calm certainty of a woman who had decided how she felt about a situation, "Eleanor has always known her own mind. It appears that quality has served her well." Eleanor sat with that sentence in the garden for a long moment after Mrs. Porter's voice moved on to something else. Her mother had said always, as if the quality had been something she'd recognized and approved of all along. As if the blue silk and the table arrangements and the 14 deployments of the word obligation had been someone else's approach entirely. Eleanor almost smiled. She didn't quite get there, but she held the sentence in her mind and turned it over, and decided with the fairness she tried to apply to everything that her mother revising history, slightly in the direction of pride, was probably not the worst thing Margaret Whitmore had ever done. And it was, when you examined it, a kind of pride, inconveniently belated, somewhat imprecise in its origins, but genuine. She went back to the Virginia scholar and wrote two more pages of objections. Alexander came at 2. He came every day now the pattern had established itself with the ease of something that had always been true, but had only recently been permitted to be visible. He came at 2. They walked or sat in the garden or talked in the parlor, depending on the weather, and her mother's management of their time, and they talked about everything except the specific thing that was building between them, the specific named thing that was getting harder to refer to only by implication. Eleanor was aware of this. She was aware that they were both in their different ways, being careful with it, not dishonest, not pretending it wasn't there, but respectful of its weight. As if naming it completely would require them to commit to holding it, and they were both still getting their balance. On Thursday, he brought her a letter, not sent through a messenger. He brought it himself and handed it to her in the garden with the directness of a man who had made a decision and was not going to hedge around it. "Before you read it,
he said. I want to tell you what it is. Eleanor looked at the letter in her hands. The paper was heavy, good quality, sealed with the Ashford crest in dark wax.
All right, she said.
It's a letter from my mother, he said. She's in Virginia. She has heard the news moves faster than I accounted for that I am calling on a Whitmore woman in Boston. She has written to ask whether her information is correct and whether she should expect to be consulted before anything is decided. He paused. I want you to read it because it tells you something about the situation I'm in that I should have told you about sooner, and because I don't intend to keep things from you when I can avoid it. Eleanor looked up at him. Is she opposed? Read the letter, he said. Then tell me what you think. She broke the seal. The handwriting was strong and angular. A woman who wrote with certainty. The letter was 3 pages. Eleanor read all of it standing in the garden with the July heat on her shoulders, while Alexander stood nearby and waited. The Duchess of Ashford Eleanor had not until this moment fully processed that this was a category of person she was now adjacent to, had written with the clarity of a woman who was accustomed to being heard. She'd written that she had understood her son would marry strategically. That the years of rejected alliances had been a source of some frustration. That, she confessed with a frankness that surprised Eleanor, largely given up expecting him to choose anyone who satisfied both the family's requirements and his own inexplicable standards. That the name Whitmore was respectable, the family's Boston connections were sound, the landholdings in Massachusetts were useful. She'd clearly had someone research this quickly, Eleanor noted, and that she had one question, and one question only before she would say anything further, and the question was, what does the girl want? Not what does she bring? Not is she suitable? What does she want? Eleanor lowered the letter. She asked what I want, she said. She did. That's not the question I expected. My mother is not the woman most people expect, Alexander said. She was married at 17 to a man she did not choose and spent the first decade of her marriage understanding exactly how the absence of that choice shapes everything that follows. She has strong opinions about it. Eleanor looked at him. Did she have a role in your rejecting the other alliances? A slight pause. She encouraged it. She said, he stopped for a moment. She said she would rather I chose no one than chose wrong. And that she would know the right person when she heard how I spoke about them. And how do you speak about me? Eleanor asked. He looked at her steadily. I told her, he said, that you were the only person I'd met in 3 years of looking who made me feel like the right version of myself instead of the managed version. He paused. I told her about the brown dress. Eleanor stared at him. She laughed, he said. First genuine laugh I've had from her in 2 years. Something moved in his expression, something personal and warm and briefly unguarded. She said anyone who would wear a brown wool dress to meet a duke on purpose was either a fool or someone worth keeping, and that I should find out which. Eleanor felt the corners of her mouth do something she couldn't entirely stop. And which am I? I've made my assessment. He said simply. She looked at the letter again. The question at the bottom of the 3rd page written in the Duchess's angular, certain hand. What does the girl want? She wants to know, Eleanor said slowly, whether I'm marrying for position. Yes. She wants to know whether I want you specifically, or whether I want what you represent. Yes. His voice was very even. And I want you to answer her honestly, not the answer that serves the situation, the true one. Eleanor folded the letter carefully, held it, thought about the brown wool dress and a conversation in a Cambridge garden and a marginal note on page 47 and a sound that had been almost a laugh for 3 weeks before it finally wasn't. Thought about the word lonely that she'd found in herself and not said aloud. Thought about walls with windows in them. I'll write to her today, Eleanor said. Eleanor, I know what I want to tell her, she said. I've known for a while. I just hadn't said it in those particular terms. She looked up at him. I want to tell her that her son is the only person I've spoken to in my adult life
who has not required me to be less than I am, and that I am that I find myself. She stopped. The words were right there. She had them. She was just finding the last step of courage required to say them. You find yourself, he said quietly, waiting. I find myself, she said, entirely unwilling to let that be temporary. The garden was quiet around them. The summer moved. Something in his face opened in a way she'd been watching for slowly for 3 weeks, the last held thing, letting go, the final managed distance closing. Write to her, he said. Tell her exactly that. I will, Eleanor said. And Alexander. Yes. Whatever she writes back, she paused. I want to read it honestly too. Even if the answer is complicated. He looked at her. She's going to want to meet you, he said. She'll want to come to Boston, or have us come to Virginia. He paused. I should tell you, Virginia is nothing like Boston. The estate is, he searched for the word, large. The social expectations are different. My mother has considerable opinions about how things are done. She asked what I want, Eleanor said, not what I'll comply with. That tells me something about how she actually operates. A short silence. Then, you're not frightened. I'm frightened of many things, Eleanor said. Your mother is not currently one of them. She paused. Ask me again after she's read my letter. She wrote the letter that afternoon at her desk. She wrote 4 drafts. The first was too careful. Too managed, the voice of a woman constructing an impression. She threw it out. The second was too blunt. The pendulum swung too far toward the kind of honesty that was more performance of honesty than the actual thing. She threw that out too. The third was closer but too long, 3 pages of justification for feelings that didn't require justification. Out. The fourth was 1 page. It said that she was Eleanor Whitmore, and that she understood the Duchess was asking a direct question and deserved a direct answer. It said that she wanted Alexander Harrington specifically, his mind, his honesty, the particular quality of his attention, the way he had remembered a conversation for 3 years, and come to Boston, and made his intentions clear, without once asking her to be different than she was. It said that she was aware of what a marriage to a man of his position would require, and that she was not unequal to those requirements, but that she needed the Duchess to understand that her compliance with requirements was not her primary value and should not be treated as such. It said in the final paragraph that she had worn a brown wool dress to meet him on purpose, and that if the Duchess was laughing at that, it meant she understood something important, which was that Eleanor Whitmore's particular variety of honesty was non-negotiable, and that she hoped it was an asset rather than a complication. She signed it, folded it, sealed it. She brought it down to Alexander the following morning herself, rather than sending it through the post, which meant she had to sit across from him while he read the address, and absorbed the fact that she'd written it quickly, and without visible anguish. He looked at her. You didn't labor over it. 4 drafts, she said. The first 3 were labor. The 4th was just the truth. He looked at the sealed letter in his hand. She's going to want to meet you immediately, he said. I'm predicting 10 days before she's arranged travel to Boston. Let her come, Eleanor said. He passed the letter to his man who was waiting near the door, and the man left with it, and Eleanor sat in the Whitmore parlor with Alexander Harrington across from her, and felt the particular quality of a situation that has reached a new stage past the beginning. Past the careful early navigation into something that was going to require different things from both of them. There's something I haven't told you, he said. Eleanor looked at him. The other alliances, he said. The ones I rejected. There were 4 of them, over 6 years. He paused. 2 were families my own mother brought to me. 1 was a connection through the legislature, a senator's daughter in Virginia, politically useful. 1 was, he stopped for a moment. 1 was Lady Harriet, 18 months ago. Eleanor was very still. There was no formal arrangement, he said quickly and clearly preempting the question she was already forming. She and I had an understanding of the kind that forms when 2 people in similar social positions spend time together and the rest of the world decides what it means before they do. I ended it.
I ended it because I understood that what she wanted from me was position, and what I needed from her was substance, and those were not the same transaction. He looked at Eleanor directly. I'm telling you now, because you should have known before this, and because I don't. I don't intend to keep things from you. Not things that matter. Eleanor took this in, filed it, turned it over honestly.
She believed you would change your mind, she said slowly.
Yes. That's why she came to Boston. I think so. I think she wasn't finished in her mind. He paused. I was finished. I should have been clearer about that earlier.
Were you? Eleanor said.
Finished. He looked at her. When I walked into your father's drawing room and saw you in that dress, he said, I was done with every other possible version of the answer. He said it simply without drama, the way he said everything that mattered. That's the truth of it. Eleanor sat with that. Let it be real, rather than managing it back into something smaller.
Lady Harriet said I was temporarily amusing, she said.
I know. She was wrong, Eleanor said. Not with anger, just precision. But I don't think she was wrong because I'm the opposite of amusing. I think she was wrong because she understood what she was seeing and couldn't accept the interpretation.
She saw me do something I'd never done, he said. Move a chair, send a book before breakfast, stay 2 hours past reason.
He paused. She understood what it meant. It frightened her.
It frightened me too, Eleanor said.
I know, he said. You're braver about fear than most people.
He looked at her steadily. You feel it, and you keep going anyway. Most people feel it and change direction.
Eleanor looked at him. How do you know what I feel?
Because I pay attention, he said.
You taught me that. Pay attention to what's actually there, not what's being performed. I've been paying attention to you for 3 weeks. There was a sound from upstairs, Bess moving through the upper hallway, the ordinary domestic sounds of a house going about its afternoon. The parlor held the specific quality of a room where something important was happening, and the room was aware of it.
Alexander, Eleanor said.
Yes.
When your mother comes.
She paused, choosing the words. I need you to let me speak for myself, not to manage it, not to translate. I'll be in the room, and I'll have my own words.
He looked at her for a long moment.
I'd expect nothing else, he said.
Some men would want to manage it, she said,
for the sake of smoothness, predictability.
I'm not interested in smoothness for its own sake, he said.
I'm interested in what's real.
He paused.
You and my mother in the same room is going to be, I won't pretend it's going to be simple. She's formed, and you're formed, and those two form things are going to have to figure each other out.
He looked at her steadily.
But I'm not afraid of it. I think you might, the almost laugh came again briefly. I think you might be the only woman I've ever met who could hold your own with her.
Don't tell her that before I arrive, Eleanor said. She'll spend the whole journey raising her expectations.
He did laugh then. Not the almost, the actual.
It was warm and brief and entirely uncontrolled, a sound that had clearly not been let out very often, and it lasted about 3 seconds before he gathered it back with the ease of long practice. But she heard the whole thing this time and filed it in the place where she kept things she didn't want to lose.
Noted, he said. The afternoon continued around them. The letter was already moving through Boston toward Virginia. The Duchess was going to read Eleanor's one page and laugh again or not laugh, and write back with whatever she wrote back, and that was going to be the next thing to navigate.
There was going to be a lot of navigating still. Eleanor knew that. She had always known how to navigate difficult terrain. She'd been doing it all her life, in rooms that didn't want her, and conversations that tried to reduce her, and a world that had very specific ideas about what a woman like her was supposed to want and be and accept. She just had to learn to navigate it without the walls. That was the new terrain. Not the Duke's mother, or the Boston social network, or Lady Harriet's residual resentment, or her own mother's complicated pride. The real new terrain was inside her, the place where the walls had been, where the settling had happened,
where something was growing now that needed room and light, and the specific courage of a woman who had been right about something large and was going to have to be equal to it. She was going to try. She had decided that. She'd decided it in a west-facing room in amber light, and she'd confirmed it in a garden with a letter in her hands. And she was confirming it again now in an ordinary parlor on an ordinary Thursday afternoon in Boston in 1815. Looking at a man who had moved a chair and sent a book and laughed out loud for 3 seconds and called it a beginning. She intended to hold him to that.
Yeah.
The response from Virginia arrived in 8 days. Not 10, as Alexander had predicted. 8. Which meant the Duchess of Ashford had read Eleanor's letter, made her assessment, and moved with the decisive speed of a woman who did not require much time to know what she thought. The letter was 2 pages this time. It arrived addressed to Eleanor directly, not to her father, not to the Whitmore household, but to Miss Eleanor Whitmore, in the same angular, certain hand as the first. It began. I have read your letter 3 times. The first time to understand it. The second to test whether I'd understood it correctly. The third for pleasure. Eleanor read that line and felt something go quiet inside her, the last remaining vigilance, the final held breath of a woman waiting for the judgment that would tell her whether she'd been right to stop performing. The Duchess wrote that she had spent 30 years watching her son be presented with women of excellent quality, who left him without exception, looking slightly more distant after each occasion than he had before. She wrote that she had understood, as mothers who pay attention sometimes do that, what he required was not excellence in the conventional sense, but something she hadn't been able to name until she read Eleanor's letter and found it named for her, a person who did not require him to be smaller in order to be acceptable to her. She wrote that she was taking the liberty of reversing the phrase because it applied in both directions, and that a woman who understood that was a woman she intended to meet at the earliest convenience. She wrote that she was coming to Boston the following Tuesday. And at the bottom of the second page in handwriting that had slightly different pressure than the rest of the letter, as if the pen had been picked back up. After a pause, she had written, "Tell me more about the brown dress. I want the full account. My son's version left out. I suspect most of the best parts." Eleanor sat at her writing desk and held the letter and felt her face do something it rarely did without warning. She sat there for a moment, letting it happen, and then she picked up her pen and began to write. The full account, she decided, was going to take several pages. The Duchess of Ashford arrived on a Tuesday as promised at 11 in the morning, which was earlier than any guest had ever arrived at the Whitmore house, and which sent the entire household into a controlled version of panic that Eleanor watched from the second floor landing, with the detached calm of a woman who had already decided how she was going to handle the next several hours. Her mother had been up since 5. Eleanor knew this because she'd heard footsteps in the hallway at 5:15 and the specific sound of Margaret Whitmore moving through a house with purpose. The quick, decisive steps of a woman running through every possible scenario and preparing a response to each one. By 9 o'clock, the parlor had been rearranged twice. The good china had been located, cleaned, and positioned. The cook had been given instructions about the tea things that were revised 3 times. Bess had been sent upstairs to ask Eleanor what she planned to wear, and Eleanor had said the gray silk, and Bess had gone back downstairs to report this, and there had been a silence from below that lasted about 40 seconds before her mother apparently decided it was an acceptable answer. At 10:45, Eleanor came downstairs. Her father was in the front hallway, looking like a man who had commanded rooms his entire life and was currently uncertain which room he was in command of. He looked at Eleanor when she came down and said without preamble, "She's a duchess." "I know what she is," Eleanor said. "I want you to," he started. "Father?" She looked at him steadily. "I wrote her a letter that told her exactly who I am. She read it and came to Boston in 8 days. Adjusting who I am for her arrival would undermine everything the letter accomplished." Thomas Whitmore looked at his daughter for a moment. Then he nodded the way he sometimes nodded when she'd made an argument he couldn't counter with the expression of a man who had produced this person and still occasionally found her startling. "All right," he said. "But stand somewhere visible when she comes in.
Eleanor said. She'll want to read the household from the entryway. Your presence matters. He straightened. Right, he said, and moved to the correct position, and Eleanor thought that her father was, when given precise instructions, actually quite good at following them. The carriage arrived at 11:05. Ig. Eleanor had constructed a picture of the Duchess in her mind from two letters and a son. The picture had been, she discovered, the moment Catherine Harrington walked through the Whitmore front door, approximately 70% accurate, which was better than most. The woman was 63 and moved like 50, with the particular authority of someone who had never once needed to soften an entrance to make it acceptable. She was not tall, shorter than Eleanor, which was unexpected, but she occupied space with a precision that made height irrelevant. Her hair was white and worn simply. Her dress was excellent and unshowy. Her eyes were the same gray as Alexander's, and they moved through the Whitmore entryway in the same rapid specific inventory Eleanor had learned to recognize as a family characteristic, filing, assessing, concluding all in under 4 seconds. Those eyes found Eleanor immediately. Not her mother who was standing closer. Not her father who had positioned himself correctly as instructed. Eleanor, who was standing slightly back from the greeting cluster in the gray silk, with her hands still and her face composed and her spine straight, watching the Duchess the way the Duchess was watching her. Miss Whitmore, the Duchess said before anyone had made an introduction. Your Grace, Eleanor said. A silence of about 3 seconds, during which the two women looked at each other with the direct, mutually assessing quality of people who have already had an important conversation in writing and are now determining whether the person in front of them matches the person on the page. Then the Duchess said, "The dress you're wearing is not brown wool." "No," Eleanor agreed. "That was for your son. This is for you." Something shifted in Catherine Harrington's face, not quite a smile. The same genetic characteristic as Alexander's, the thing that happened beneath a smile when the smile itself was still deciding. Honest, she said, not to Eleanor, to the room in general, as if confirming a conclusion she'd already reached. Good. She turned to Margaret Whitmore and produced a warmer expression, the expression of a woman who can modulate her manner with precision. Mrs. Whitmore, your hospitality is very kind. I've heard excellent things about your household. Margaret received this with the composure of a woman who had been preparing for this moment since Tuesday of the previous week and was not going to waste the preparation. We are honored, she said, and meant it, and the drawing room opened around them all. The tea was poured. The pleasantries were made. Eleanor's father talked about Massachusetts for 12 minutes with the practiced ease of a man on familiar ground, and the Duchess listened with genuine interest and asked 3 questions that demonstrated she'd done her reading about New England land politics before arriving, which earned her a visible upgrade in Thomas Whitmore's assessment. Eleanor sat and watched. She was not performing patience. She was genuinely patient. This was information, all of it, the way the Duchess held her cup and where she directed her attention and how she responded when the conversation shifted from comfortable to specific. Eleanor was collecting it the way she collected everything quietly, without apparent urgency, building a picture that was more complete than any single observation could provide. The Duchess caught her watching. Their eyes met across the tea service. Catherine Harrington set her cup down. Mrs. Whitmore, she said pleasantly, I wonder if I might impose on your husband for a brief moment. There's a question about the Western Massachusetts land situation that I understand was recently resolved, and I'd very much like to hear his account of the terms. I believe it may be relevant to some business I'm involved with in Virginia. It was so precisely constructed, the compliment to Thomas embedded in the request, the removal of Margaret from the room, justified by business rather than exclusion, that Eleanor almost admired it openly. Her father stood with the gratified eagerness of a man invited to discuss something he understood well, and her mother followed with the graciousness of someone who recognized the move and chose to honor it. And within 90 seconds, Eleanor was alone in the parlor with the Duchess of Ashford. The door closed. There, said Catherine Harrington. Now we can talk properly. Eleanor looked at her. You've been waiting to do that since you came through the door.
since I read your letter, the Duchess said. She picked her cup back up and held it with both hands and looked at Eleanor directly. My son is not easy to know. I suspect you've discovered that. He's very clear about what he thinks, Eleanor said. That's not the same as easy, but it's honest. I prefer honest.
So do I, the Duchess said. It's a preference that has cost me socially for 40 years. She paused.
Tell me about the dress.
Eleanor looked at her for a moment. Then she told her. Not the managed version. Not the version where it was a calculated statement. The real version. The exhaustion behind it. The accumulation of years of being required to be smaller. The specific morning clarity of pulling that dress from the back of the wardrobe and feeling for the first time in recent memory that she was going to be entirely herself, regardless of what it cost her. The Duchess listened without interruption. When Eleanor finished, the older woman was quiet for a moment. Then she said, I was married in a dress my mother chose. To a man my father chose. In a ceremony that was entirely correct by every available standard. She paused. I was 22 years into that marriage before I fully understood what I had agreed to, which was to manage everything and decide nothing. She set her cup down. Alexander watched that. He watched it from childhood. He understood what it produced in me, which was competence and bitterness in equal measure, and he decided somewhere along the way that he would not replicate it. Eleanor held the older woman's gaze. He told me he'd rejected 4 alliances, she said. He said you encouraged the rejections. Every one of them, the Duchess said without hesitation. 3 of those women were perfectly acceptable. 1 of them was exceptional by every conventional measure. And not one of them would have made him feel like himself instead of like his title. She paused. That was the problem, you see. He was always with all of them his title, a position to be obtained, a social outcome to be achieved, not a person. She looked at Eleanor. You spoke to him like he was a person. He wrote to me about it before he'd even decided to come to Boston. Eleanor went very still. He wrote to you about Cambridge. 3 years ago, the Duchess said simply. He wrote and said he'd had a conversation with a young woman in his cousin's garden, and that it was the first time in 4 years of social obligations that he'd felt something like genuine interest, and that he didn't know what to do with it. She paused. I wrote back and told him to find her. He took 3 years to act on the advice. Why? Eleanor said. And then, hearing the question, the real question underneath it, why did he wait? She felt the weight of 3 years land differently than it had before. Not as absence, as consideration. Because he wasn't certain, the Duchess said. And my son, whatever his other qualities, does not move on uncertainty. He waits until he's sure, and then he moves without hesitation. She held Eleanor's gaze. He's sure now. I've never heard him speak of anyone the way he spoke of you in his last letter. What did he say? Eleanor said. The Duchess smiled. It reached her eyes this time, the full thing warm and private and slightly wry. He said you argued with his page marginalia, she said. He said you'd written 3 pages of objections to a book he'd sent you before breakfast. And he said it was the most attractive thing he'd encountered in 32 years of existence. Eleanor felt warmth move through her from somewhere central. She looked at the window, gathered herself. Your Grace. Catherine, the Duchess said. Eleanor looked back at her. I'm not going to be manageable, she said. I want you to understand that before we go further, I'll be respectful and I'll be honest and I'll try to be fair. But I'm not going to perform a particular version of myself for the sake of a social requirement. I did that for years and I was not good at it, and it was not good for me. The Duchess looked at her for a long moment. Eleanor, she said. And the use of her first name landed with the specific weight of a decision rather than a formality. I have spent 63 years being manageable. I have managed estates and households and social calendars and political relationships and a son who required more careful management than any of the rest combined, because you cannot manage someone whose mind runs faster than your strategy. She paused. The last thing I want is another manageable woman in this family. Silence in the parlor.
real silence, the kind that has things in it.
I think, Eleanor said carefully, that I'm going to like you.
I know I'm going to like you, the Duchess said. I decided on page one of your letter.
She stood and Eleanor stood automatically, and the older woman crossed the small distance between them and did something unexpected. She took Eleanor's hands, both of them, and held them in the same way Cecily had held her hand in the garden, with the same specific warmth of a woman who had decided that something was worth touching.
He's not easy, Catherine said quietly. I told you that. He holds things. He doesn't let people in quickly. And when he does let them in, he holds that too very carefully, like he's afraid of what happens if he isn't careful.
She paused. He's let you in, faster than he's ever let anyone in. I want you to know what that means, so you can take care of it properly.
Eleanor looked at the older woman's face. The gray eyes, the white hair, the 63 years of competence and adaptation, and the particular kind of strength that comes from surviving things you didn't choose. She thought about Alexander in rooms where everyone wanted something from him. She thought about the quality of absence she'd noticed in him when he was talking to people who didn't hold his interest. The careful management of his own presence. The thing he'd described as lonely without using the word.
I know what it means, Eleanor said. The Duchess squeezed her hands once and let go.
Alexander arrived at 4. He came in through the front door to find his mother in the parlor, and Eleanor beside her, and the two women in conversation, with the specific quality of a discussion that has moved well past pleasantries into something with real content. He stood in the doorway and looked at them, and something crossed his face that Eleanor caught before he had time to manage it. Relief, she thought. Real unguarded relief, the kind that comes when something you were quietly afraid of turns out to be all right.
You're early, his mother said.
You're still here, he said. I expected... He stopped, looked at Eleanor. Is everything...
Everything is fine, Eleanor said.
She wrote me 3 pages of objections to the Virginian scholar before breakfast. Catherine said to no one in particular, I find I like her method. Alexander came fully into the room. He sat in the chair his mother had vacated, which placed him adjacent to Eleanor close enough that the warmth of presence was a specific thing rather than an ambient one. He looked at her with the gray directness she'd come to need, the way you need a fixed point when everything around you is moving.
3 pages, he said.
The argument in chapter 4 has a structural problem, Eleanor said. The conclusion doesn't follow from the premises if you accept the second axiom, which I do. It unravels the whole thing. I told you it would make you argue with the page.
You said that like it was a warning, she said.
It wasn't. It was a recommendation.
He was quiet for a moment. Then the thing that had almost been a laugh for weeks, that had finally been actual for 3 seconds. In the parlor moved through his expression again. Freer this time, more natural, as if it was getting easier to let it be visible.
You're right, he said.
It was.
His mother watched this exchange with the expression of a woman seeing something confirmed. She stood.
I'm going to find your father, she said to Eleanor, which meant she was going to find Thomas Whitmore and give his son the room, which was Eleanor recognized the Duchess managing something while appearing to do something else entirely, and doing it with considerably more grace than Margaret Whitmore had managed the same maneuver. She was gone in under a minute.
Alexander looked at Eleanor.
She likes you, he said.
I know, Eleanor said.
I like her.
She doesn't like most people.
I know that too.
Eleanor paused.
She told me you wrote to her about Cambridge, 3 years ago.
He looked at her steadily.
Yes.
You told her about the conversation.
I told her you were the most interesting person I'd spoken to in years, he said.
I didn't know your full name at the time. I had to find it later through your cousin's family.
Eleanor took a breath.
You found my full name?
Last year, he said.
I found out you were in Boston.
I found out your father was Thomas Whitmore, and that the family situation was I did my research.
He paused.
I want to be transparent about the fact that I knew considerably more about you before I walked into your father's drawing room than you knew about me.
That's an asymmetry, Eleanor said.
It is, he agreed.
I'm sorry for it.
I wasn't certain how to close it without frightening you off, and then I saw the brown dress and understood that frightening you off was probably not something I was capable of.
Eleanor looked at him. What does that mean?
It means, he said with the evenness he used when he was being most precise, that a woman who would walk into a room deliberately refusing to perform for an important guest is not a woman who frightens easily. And I'd spent 3 years being slightly afraid that you would, that if I approached directly you would...
He stopped, started again. I was afraid you'd find it excessive, the remembering.
3 years of remembering a conversation, Eleanor said.
Yes, you thought I'd find that excessive.
He held her gaze.
Wouldn't you have?
Before this.
Eleanor thought about it honestly. She thought about the woman she'd been at the beginning of July, the walls at full height, the defenses intact, the carefully constructed posture of a person who expected rejection and had preempted it with refusal. She thought about what she would have done with a man who arrived at her father's door, saying he'd been thinking about her for 3 years.
Yes, she said.
I would have. I would have decided it was strange or strategic or...
She paused. I would have found a way to make it not real.
I know, he said. That's why I came without announcing it. I wanted you to encounter the actual person before you encountered the information.
He paused. I wanted you to decide for yourself.
Eleanor was quiet for a moment.
That was, she said, either very calculated or very considerate.
Possibly both.
Both, he said without apology.
I'd decided I wanted you to have a real choice. Not a choice shaped by the weight of what I'd been thinking about for 3 years. A real one based on who I actually was in front of you.
He looked at her directly.
Did you get that a real choice?
She thought about the brown dress and the moved chair and the book before breakfast and page 47 and 3 pages of philosophical objections and a laugh that had finally happened out loud.
Yes, she said. I got a real choice.
And, she looked at him. I'm still here, Alexander. He was very still for a moment. Then he reached into the breast pocket of his coat and brought out a small object and held it for a moment in his closed hand. And Eleanor's heart did the thing it had been doing at increasingly frequent intervals over the past 3 weeks. The irregular thing, the thing without a clinical name, that was simply the body registering something the mind had already understood.
I want to do this correctly, he said. I know the formal arrangement has been made with your father. I know my mother's approval is not in question. I know Boston's social machinery is going to have processed everything within 48 hours, and the situation is already... It's already what it is in the world's understanding of it.
He paused. But I want to ask you. Not the arrangement.
You.
Eleanor looked at his closed hand. At his face. At the 32 years in it, the intelligence and the patience and the careful management and the thing underneath all the management that had been waiting for somewhere, it didn't have to be maintained.
Ask me, she said.
He opened his hand. The ring was small and precisely made, not showy, not weighted with the ostentatious display of great wealth, but beautifully crafted a sapphire. The deep blue of summer evening, surrounded by very small diamonds, set flush into the band. It was the ring of a man who had thought about the person who would wear it, not the statement it would make on her hand.
Eleanor Whitmore, he said.
I have been thinking about you for 3 years. I have come to Boston and found that you are more than I remembered, and I remembered you clearly.
He paused.
I am not asking you to fit into my life. I am asking you to build something with me that neither of us has the shape of yet, because I think whatever it is will be better than what either of us would build alone.
He held her gaze.
Will you marry me?
The parlor was quiet. Somewhere in the house, the sound of her mother's voice and his mother's voice in the same room, two women who had spent 20 years managing their respective households, finding Eleanor suspected a great deal to discuss. Somewhere further, her father's voice explaining something about Massachusetts.
Eleanor looked at the ring.
She looked at the man.
She thought about every room she'd stood in wearing the wrong dress on purpose. Refusing to perform, holding herself at a careful distance from anything that might require her to be vulnerable. She thought about the specific loneliness of being the person in the room who understood what was actually happening,
while everyone around her understood only the surface. She thought about what it had felt like over the past 3 weeks to speak the complete thought to someone who could hold the full weight of it. She thought about how she had come downstairs on a July morning to refuse everything. And she thought about what it meant that the refusal had been the truest thing she'd ever done. And that the truest thing she'd ever done had led her here to this man, to this question, to this moment, where the answer was not a performance of any kind, but simply the truth of what she was. "Yes," she said. He put the ring on her finger. His hands were steady. She noticed that the steadiness of them, the same steadiness he brought to everything, the quality of a man who had waited 3 years for the right answer, and now that he had it, was not going to fumble it. He held her hand for a moment after, not letting go, just held it. "The brown dress?" he said quietly. His voice was different from how it was when other people were in the room, lower the control reduced by a degree, the thing underneath it more audible. "I want you to keep it." Eleanor looked up at him. "Why?" "Because in 40 years, he said, "I want to be able to show our daughters what honest looks like." Something happened in her chest at that, at daughters at 40 years, at the image of a future so specific and warm and unhurried that it felt like a room she could actually walk into. She felt her face do the thing it had been doing more frequently since he'd arrived in her life. The thing she couldn't entirely stop that happened without warning in the specific vicinity of this man. She let it happen. "You're going to need a larger library," she said. He looked at her. "I have 14 rooms I don't use." "Then you have space," she said. He did laugh, then full unmanaged the real thing, warm and private, and entirely his. It lasted longer than 3 seconds this time. Eleanor sat beside him in the Whitmore parlor and listened to it, and thought that she would remember this sound for the rest of her life, the sound of a man who had been very careful for a very long time, letting something go finally, because he'd found somewhere safe to put it down. The announcement moved through Boston in under 24 hours. Eleanor heard about it from Cecily, first Cecily, who came to her room before breakfast the following morning with the expression of a woman who has been waiting her whole life to deliver good news to her sister, and is savoring the approach. She sat on the edge of Eleanor's bed and said, "It's in the morning papers. Mother had someone place it last night." "Of course she did," Eleanor said. "She also," Cecily said, with the particular careful delivery of a person sharing something they aren't certain how it will land, "apparently had a very long conversation with the Duchess of Ashford yesterday afternoon about the management of large households, and the specific challenges of daughters who refuse to be managed, and they appear to have found common ground." Eleanor looked at her sister. "I think," Cecily said, "that they may have become friends." Eleanor thought about two women who had each spent decades managing extraordinary amounts of resistance in their respective households finally finding a peer. "That," she said, "is either the best possible outcome or the most dangerous one." Cecily smiled. "Probably both." Eleanor looked at the ring on her hand, the sapphire in the morning light. "Cecily," she said. "Yes." "I need you to tell me something honestly." "Always," her sister said. "When I came downstairs in the brown dress," Eleanor said, "did you know what was going to happen?" Cecily was quiet for a moment. Then, "I knew that whatever happened was going to be real," she said. "Because you were being real. And I thought," she paused, choosing the words, "I thought that real things attract real things, and that whatever came through that door, it would respond to what you actually were, instead of what you were performing." She looked at her sister steadily. "I hoped it would be him. I couldn't have guaranteed it. But I hoped." Eleanor looked at her for a long moment. "Thank you," she said, "for not trying to stop me." "I would never," Cecily said simply. The morning of the formal engagement announcement, Mrs. Porter came to call. Eleanor received her in the parlor alone, which was a choice her mother offered to be present, and Eleanor declined politely and finally, and her mother accepted the decision with the ease of a woman who had been learning recently to trust her daughter's navigation. Mrs. Porter sat with her tea and her social mathematics and looked at Eleanor Whitmore. Eleanor Whitmore, who was now Eleanor Whitmore, soon to be Harrington,
which was a recalculation of considerable magnitude with the expression of a woman who has been holding a particular opinion for some time and is deciding whether to revise it.
"I owe you an apology," Mrs. Porter said. Eleanor looked at her.
"Do you?"
"I repeated something I shouldn't have repeated," Mrs. Porter said.
"Lady Harriet's comment.
I brought it here and I presented it as information when it was something else."
She paused.
"I think I believed it was true. I think I believed that what she said about you, the temporarily amusing, I think I held the same opinion, and she simply voiced it."
"Why are you telling me this?" Eleanor asked.
"Because I was wrong," Mrs. Porter said. "And I've been wrong about you for some time, and I suspect I've communicated that wrongness in ways that cost you socially."
She held Eleanor's gaze without flinching.
"I'm telling you because I believe in accounting for things when the accounting is due."
Eleanor looked at her for a long moment.
"The opinion you held," she said.
"What specifically was it?"
Mrs. Porter was quiet for a moment.
"That you were too difficult," she said.
"Too much. Too opinionated and too unwilling to moderate it. That the kind of man who would suit you would have to be a very particular kind of man. And I thought that kind of man didn't exist, or if he did, he wouldn't find his way to you through the particular channels available."
She paused.
"I was wrong about the last part.
He found his way," Eleanor said.
"Because I stopped moderating," she said.
"The thing you thought would prevent it was the thing that caused it."
Mrs. Porter absorbed this.
"Yes," she said. "I can see that now."
"For what it's worth," Eleanor said, and she felt the generosity of it as she said it. "The genuine thing rather than the performed thing, the opinion was understandable. I've been difficult by the available standards, I know that.
The standards may require revision," Mrs. Porter said.
Eleanor looked at her.
"They may,"
she agreed.
They drank their tea. The morning moved around them. And when Mrs. Porter left 20 minutes later, she left with something Eleanor recognized as the beginning of a revised assessment. Not friendship. Not yet possibly, not ever, but the beginning of genuine regard, which was more honest than the false warmth that had been the alternative and which Eleanor preferred in exactly the way she preferred everything real, overperformed, true, overconvenient.
Three days before they left Boston for Virginia, Eleanor went up to the back of her wardrobe and took out the brown wool dress. She held it for a moment. The fraying cuffs. The collar that sat slightly wrong. The ghost hem. The November wool in July heat. All of it. She had worn it as a refusal. She had walked downstairs in it as a declaration of exhaustion and resistance, as the distilled product of 6 years of being required to perform as the most honest she could manage on a morning when she'd stopped caring about the cost. And it had been, she understood now, in a way she hadn't understood, then the truest thing she'd ever worn. Not because it was ugly, or because it made a point, or because it had impressed anyone. Because it was real. Because she'd put it on with both hands steady, and walked into a room as herself without the blue silk, and without the performance in the room had contained the one person in her experience who had looked at a woman refusing to perform and seen behind the refusal the actual person refusing. She folded it carefully, placed it in the cedar chest at the foot of her bed, the chest where she kept things she didn't want to lose, put it at the bottom under the letters and the journals and the Cambridge Garden memory and all the rest of the life she was going to carry forward. Cecily was in the doorway.
"You're keeping it."
"He asked me to," Eleanor said.
"So did I before he asked."
Cecily came in and sat on the edge of the bed. They were quiet together, in the way they'd been quiet together since childhood, the specific silence of two people who didn't need noise to be present.
"Are you frightened?" Cecily asked.
"Virginia. The estate. All of it." Eleanor thought about it honestly. The way she thought about everything.
"Yes," she said, "and I'm going anyway."
She paused.
"That's what I've learned to do. Feel it, and go."
"You always went," Cecily said.
"Even before."
"Before I went as resistance," Eleanor said.
"This is different.
This is going toward... She paused. I haven't done much of that.
Cecily looked at her sister.
You'll be good at it, she said simply.
Eleanor closed the cedar chest. Stood. Looked at her room, the writing desk, with the lock still on it. The journals stacked along the wall. The small mirror above the washstand that had witnessed 2 weeks and a lifetime ago. The moment she'd looked at herself in the wrong dress and felt something close to peace. She wasn't that woman anymore. She was still all of what that woman had been. The refusal, the intelligence, the walls, the honesty. But she was something else now too. Something with forward momentum. Something that had decided on a July morning in Boston to be completely itself, and had found that being completely itself had made room for exactly the life it had been too afraid to want.
Alexander came for her on a Wednesday morning. She walked out of the Whitmore house with her traveling cases and her cedar chest, and her mother's kiss on her cheek, and her father's hand holding hers for a long moment before releasing it, and she got into the carriage and the door closed, and Boston began to move past the windows. Alexander was beside her. He didn't speak immediately. He let the moment be what it was. The leaving that was also arriving the specific gravity of a threshold, crossed without going back. Then he said quietly, "All right." Eleanor looked at him.
"Yes," she said.
He took her hand, held it. The sapphire caught the morning light. Outside Boston continued its summer. The Charles River, the brick of Beacon Hill, the particular heat of July pressing against the carriage windows, the smell of the city in its warmth, the sounds of a place that had been her whole world contracting slowly behind her as the horses moved. She did not look back. She was not a woman who needed to look back at the rooms she'd left. She had learned to inventory things in real time, to know exactly what she was leaving while she was still in it, to carry it correctly, rather than only recognizing it in absence. She knew what she was leaving. She knew what she was carrying forward. She knew what she was going toward. She held Alexander Harrington's hand in a carriage moving south out of Boston on a July Wednesday in 1815 and felt for the first time in her adult life that the full weight of who she was had found something equal to carry it. She had not changed. She had not softened or moderated or performed any version of herself that was less than the original. She had worn the worst dress she owned into a room full of expectation and refused to apologize for it, and the refusal had been the beginning of the truest story of her life. And the truest story of her life was this. She had been seen fully precisely, without reduction by the one person capable of seeing her, and she had seen him in return. And what they had built between them in 3 weeks of honesty was more real and more solid and more right than anything either of them had built in years of careful management. Eleanor Whitmore did not change to be loved. She was exactly herself completely and without apology. And the right man learned had already learned 3 years before she knew it to see her correctly. That was the whole of it. That was all it had ever needed to be. And as the carriage carried her forward into everything that came next, she understood with the quiet certainty of a woman who had finally stopped arguing with the evidence that the brown wool dress in the cedar chest was not a memory of refusal. It was proof, the most honest proof she owned, that the life you're meant to live has a way of finding you if you're brave enough to stop pretending to be someone it won't recognize. She was found. She was known. She was going home.